I'd like to call the meeting to order, and I see that you've totally mixed up the seating arrangements, so that...
We just go where we are told.
I'm just so confused.
That's our goal, Dave.
Yeah, okay, well, you've managed to do it. You totally managed to do it.
So
I'm looking for Tom Landwehr, always over here, there he is over there, you know.
I'm as confused as ever, so...
Yes, well...
So your dinner table is always the same?
Always. McDonald's.
And he's in the driver's seat?
Same booth. Well, as you can tell by the opening, we have a lot of heavy information to handle here this morning. So we have really no action items on the agenda. So today is information and a lot of it. And so I thank the members of the staff for your hard work and preparation, and look forward to a good discussion. At this point, you do have in front of you the agenda and the minutes of the June meeting. If there are no additions or corrections to the minutes or comments on the agenda, a motion to approve both would be in order.
Move approval.
Second.
Motion, and there is a second. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. I did question the need for introductions, but as we talked earlier about the agenda, but oh well, what the heck. Sandy, you want to introduce yourself to the crowd?
Sandy Rommel, Mac Council.
Kate Knuth, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Ryan Napstad, Bowser.
John Stein, PCA.
Spencer Cronk, Department of Administration.
Oh heck, I'm Ed Ellinger, Commissioner of Health.
I'm Charlie Zelli, Commissioner of Department of Transportation.
I'm Dave Fredrickson, MDA.
Will Seifert, EQB.
Katie Clark-Sieben, Commissioner of Deed.
Kristen Ivey-Tollison, citizen member from Southeast Minnesota.
Tom Landwehr, Commissioner of DNR.
Julie Gehring, citizen member from Moorhead.
Thank you. I'm going to duck out of the chair's report, given the fact that I have nothing to report. And I'll go directly to Executive Director Will Seifert's report.
Man of many words, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I had a note on here to actually make a comment about parking, but I don't think we have to worry about covering that today. So we are going to just move on. The next silica sand rulemaking advisory panel meeting is scheduled for this coming Thursday, a week from tomorrow, with most of the agenda reserved for discussion of environmental review thresholds. This we'll be looking at the survey that we sent out to our panelists, so it should be a really rich discussion, and then we're going to bring that back to the board for discussion at our September meeting. This will not be a decision item. It will just be a conversation about the rule and which direction we think we're going to go with it. An update on the Minnesota Sands EIS. EQB staff have not yet received a payment, a signed cost agreement, or a data submittal from Minnesota Sands for the multi-site project at this time, so we'll provide a status update should this change. And then just a reminder that the Governor's Clean Energy and Economic Development Summit is scheduled for tomorrow morning, July 17th, at the University of Minnesota McNamara Center from 7:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. I strongly encourage you all, as does Commissioner Clark-Sieben, to attend if you're able, and they are taking walk-ins, so you don't have to worry about registering. Just show up and you get in. Our next meeting is going to be August 20th in Duluth. Just a reminder, there's a little travel there. It'll be at the Duluth City Council Chambers, and we'll be presenting our climate report at this meeting. And then just a couple comments briefly on our water presentation here before we get started. I wanted to provide a little bit of brief context for today. In 2013, the EQB participated in a strategic planning process facilitated by the Governor's Institute on Community Design. One of the recommendations that came out of that process, as well as the Environmental Congress that preceded it, was that the EQB should renew its focus on water management coordination. In fulfillment of that priority, we have invited member agencies to present to the board their signature interagency water management initiatives today and then again at future meetings. We've also asked staff to compile an inventory of existing interagency efforts related to water management. As a starting point, MPCA will be presenting the Water Governance Evaluation 2014 update This report was initially completed at the direction of the 2012 legislature and subsequently updated. It provides a recent inventory of this ongoing integrated water governance effort. I've also asked staff to make a brief presentation this afternoon on our statutory requirements pertaining to this issue. As many of you know, EQB's water program has a rich history, but has evolved over time for many reasons. This statutory overview should help provide some historical context as we hear presentations from the various agencies over the upcoming months. And as our silica sand climate and environmental review programs remain our focus for this calendar year, we wanted to spend some time with the board on water management issues as they intersect with all these programs. So that concludes my comments.
All right. Any questions for Will? Seeing none, Commissioner Clark Sieben, do you want to make a pitch for tomorrow's meeting after you shamelessly got the executive director to do it for you?
I did, I admit. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Will did an excellent job.
He did.
But yes, please come tomorrow at McNamara Alumni Center. We have about 250 registered so far, but we do have room for more. So help get the word out. This is, to our knowledge, the first time there's been a Minnesota Clean Energy Summit where we're bringing together all these industries under one roof. And there have been multiple industry roundtables that have taken place leading up to tomorrow's event. So I think it'll be a great event. The governor will kick it off and provide the morning keynote. And we have a full agenda. It concludes at 1:30-ish, so a half day. So hope to see you there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're very welcome, and I will be there bright and early tomorrow morning. All right. Carolyn? I think we're ready for your presentation, you and Amy.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, my name is Caroline Magnuson and I'm EQB staff. Today we would like to provide an update on our environmental review internship as it draws to a close at the end of July. But first, I would like to provide a little bit of background for you. In 2011, Governor Dayton issued Executive Order 1132 directing the work of the EQB, specifically calling out environmental review processes as complex and needing review and revision. From this order, the EQB evaluated and made recommendations on how to improve environmental review, resulting in six prioritized recommendations. The first of these recommendations was to strengthen EQB capacity for oversight and assistance, and number two was to develop a better system for making the information available. Since the EQB is in the process of migrating its website to another platform, our goal in this internship was to update and improve our most used documents by citizens to understand environmental review and make sure they are ready to go on our new website. As Kate Franz discussed back in February, we pursued a partnership with the U of M on revising our Citizens Guide documents with Professors Karen Ballin and Ed Nader's undergraduate environmental review class. Staff presented to the class in April and discussed the role that EQB plays in environmental review, as well as going over the class's assignment, which was to critique and evaluate the documents. At the end of the semester, 60 student evaluations were collected from the class, and an intern was selected to look over the students' feedback and revise the citizens' guides to improve accuracy, clarity, and effectiveness. The environmental review intern, Amy Hooley, has worked through updating information, reformatting the documents, incorporating the governor's plain language initiative, and overall shortening the documents substantially while keeping vital information. I will now turn it over to her to present her final draft documents and recommendations.
Welcome, Amy.
Thanks. Mr. Chair, members of the board, the project I'm working on contains the following goals and objectives. The first one would be to review and revise the four Environmental Quality Board Citizen Guide documents, which are a Citizen's Guide, the petition process, a Citizen's Guide, local government environmental decision-making, a Citizen's Guide commenting on environmental review projects, and a Citizen's Guide introduction to environmental review. By the end of July, I hope to have developed revised mock-ups of the four documents. Currently, I have revised mock-ups of three of the three documents, the first three. The document yet to be finished is the Citizen's Guide to Introduction to Environmental Review, which I'll talk about in the recommendations section. Another goal of the project was to present the final mock-ups and recommendations to the Environmental Quality Board at this meeting. At the beginning of my internship, I received suggestions and critiques for the four Citizen's Guide documents from my fellow undergraduate classmates in my environmental review class. The past few months, I have reviewed the suggestions and critiques and have analyzed them for the practicality of implementation. Later, I will present the list of recommendations I've developed. Okay, I'll start by going over the changes I've made to the documents. As you can see, I've incorporated the new logo for the Environmental Quality Board. These pictures represent the old documents cover page titled Before and the new documents cover page titled After. I've also rearranged and reformatted the documents. This is an example of the Citizen's Guide, the petition process documents, old and new table of contents. In each of the four documents, I've changed the header font, increased the font size, and changed the spacing, making the documents easier to read and easier to find information within them. Along with rearranging and reformatting the documents, I've simplified and shortened them. I did this by taking out necessary filler words, simplifying sentences, and taking out or updating outdated information. I worked with the Governor's Plain Language Initiative to accomplish this as well. The pictures shown are an example of the introduction from the Citizen's Guide, the petition process document. Overall, Citizen's Guide Commenting on Environmental Review Project has been shortened by 3 pages, and a Citizen's Guide Local Government Environmental Decision Making and a Citizen's Guide the Petition Process have been shortened by 2 pages. Each document has considerably less text, making it easier to read and find information needed by the person reading the document. And again, Introduction to Environmental Review is not complete yet, so I'll talk about that in the recommendation section. Another change I made to the documents would be creating new figures to replace the dense text blocks, making the documents easier to read and understand. This is an example of the flowchart I created to explain the petition process. It replaces the old document's numbered outline of the process, making the process easier to follow and visualize. I've also added tables where appropriate to break up information that may otherwise be hard to read and remember. This is an example of the Citizen's Guide Commenting on Environmental Review Projects document and goes over the timeline for the commenting periods. Lastly, I've added new Venn diagram figures to help display information in a more comprehensible way that is easier to read and understand. This is an example of the Citizen's Guide Local Government Environmental Decision Making document that goes over cities, townships, and counties. It was discussed that some new documents would be very helpful to provide more clarity to the Citizen's Guide documents. The first new document, titled Quick Reference, the Petition Process, has a flowchart of the petition process on the front and a petition checklist on the back. It also contains the address and email for the Environmental Quality Board so people know where to submit their petitions, as well as a reminder to send a notification letter to the project proposer. Also, a template was made for the petition signature form and the proposer notification, so people submitting a petition can access these and fill them out easily. This was also strongly recommended by my classmates. We also decided to take the additional information page out of the old Citizen's Guide Local Government Environmental Decision-Making document and create a single page of additional information people can read if they have further concerns or questions after reading the Citizen's Guide documents. Okay. To summarize, I've rearranged and reformatted the documents. I've simplified and shortened each document by at least 2 pages or more. And I did that using the Governor's Plain Language Initiative And I've also created new figures, including flowcharts, tables, and Venn diagrams, and I've created new documents. Okay. Now I'd like to present the recommendation list I came up with by reviewing and analyzing the suggestions and critiques given by my classmates. The first and most common recommendation is to include more real-life examples for the petitioning and commenting documents. I would suggest to accomplish this by composing two separate libraries, one consisting of previously submitted comments and the other consisting of previously submitted petitions. This would be great because then people can access real-life examples and see what a submitted comment or petition looks like and how they're generally laid out and formatted. Also, creating easy links on the new website to these libraries would be very helpful. The second recommendation was also very common, and it is to create a glossary document containing the most commonly used terms and abbreviations by the EQB and the Citizens Guide documents. My suggestion to accomplish this would be to create a new document titled a Citizens Guide Glossary that includes the abbreviations in a table format and terms in a dictionary format as shown in the slide. The fourth document, Citizens Guide, an Introduction to Environmental Review, is we're working on finalizing, and a lot of it is being merged into a glossary, which is why we're not finished with it yet. The third recommendation is to clarify what the EQB is, what it does, and what kind of authority they have. I would suggest creating a Who Are We tab or section on the homepage of the Environmental Review website that addresses these questions. The fourth recommendation would be to improve contact information for the different governmental agencies. People were wondering where to go to find information about different environmental impacts of a project. I suggest that EQB create a directory people can refer to with department names and what issues they cover, so people will know who to contact regarding specific research information they wish to acquire. The directory should also have easy accessible links on the new website. Other recommendations that I thought of as I was revising the documents include updating the website links regularly, because many of the old document website links were broken links or connected to error pages, so they weren't very helpful. Another recommendation I thought of was to keep the Word documents of the finalized revisions of the four Citizens Guide documents, because the old documents were only found in PDF format, and it was very hard to update them when they're in PDF format. So, thank you for your time, and I'll turn it back over to Caroline.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, our next steps going forward will be for environmental review staff to review the documents and finalize them, as well as the recommendations, so they are ready to be updated and put on the new website platform as we move forward to improve environmental review support. We're very impressed by the work that Amy did over the course of the summer, and very happy we were able to work with the U of M in a partnership on this internship project. Looking forward, we hope to continue this relationship and involve students that will be hopefully working with us in the environmental review field as practitioners in the future. So if you
Amy, how did you like the experience?
I liked it. It was
good
nice.
Answer.
Yeah.
And your colleagues or your classmates were heavily involved in recommending and.
Yep. Yeah. They all each wrote. It was an assignment at the very end of our class to write recommendations on the four Citizens Guide documents.
And their reaction to the old one was.
Some people thought it was okay, but most people thought it was kind of long, and they wanted glossaries and real life examples. Those were the two that popped out the most.
Okay, so examples were always came back.
Yeah, yeah.
We should, give us a sense of what you're looking for, kind of process. So I asked you yesterday or 2 days ago if you'd gotten, like the Jay Leno person on the street reaction. So you haven't taken it down on University Avenue and said, "What do you think of
it?" I haven't done that yet. No.
Maybe
next step.
Yeah.
Next step. Okay. Yeah. And how long will you be with us?
2 more weeks after this.
2 more weeks, yep. Okay. Well, it's been great having you there.
Oh, thank you.
Good job. Other questions?
Mr. Chair, Amy, just curious as to what advice you have for us. So a lot of us around the table are now charged within their own agencies to implement plain language initiatives. For example, I oversee all the contracting for the state, and we're looking at our RFQs and the different contracts that the state has. What advice would you have for me on, as we look through our own documents, how to make them more accessible to a broader audience?
I would just try to simplify them as much as you can, because when you get into big details or complicated details, I think you can lose a lot of your audience.
So maybe we
first of all tell us what an RFQ is. That would be a
I don't know what that is. No.
To really though, to have your classmates as a backup is really interesting, and to have someone to bounce this off, and maybe there's some, you know, that in itself would be, I think, helpful to all of us.
Yeah.
Using a targeted group. So Charlie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Amy, I noticed that you're actually working off of something that was revised in 2005.
Yeah.
From another student effort. Yep. I'm just curious, did you see, wow, what that would have looked like 10 years ago? I mean, because it sounds like we're making improvements along the way, but what did it look like back then?
Like the old documents, yeah. What did they look like? They were kind of long and hard to read through. Yeah, I actually worked off them. Those were the PDFs that I originally started with. And then I retyped all of them into Word so we could update them easier. But yeah, they were long and very text heavy. So I tried to incorporate the new figures to make them less text heavy.
Right.
Yeah.
Good. Great work.
Mr. Stein, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Amy, how many students are in the class that helped you with this? What was the number? And
I think it was 60 students around there.
Okay.
I'm not sure exactly.
And are they from a lot of different degree programs or where?
Most of them are in the environmental science track at the University of Minnesota.
Great.
So,
thanks.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, we also have one of the professors here, Karen Ballin, is actually here too, so I don't know if you have any further questions or comments. It was a very good project to work on with them, and if you have any further follow-up, feel free to let us know afterwards.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
Okay. Amy, I would just recommend that you send your resume around to all of these
okay.
after today's presentation, because I think you might have a few interested.
Yes. Nice job.
Thank you.
Nice job.
Ms. Baumann, would you like to share any comments as far as your experience?
My colleague and I, who co-taught the class, certainly appreciated being able to give one of our students such real-world experience. Yeah. It's really invaluable. And also the assignment for the class in general, that was the only assignment they had that was applicable to the real world where they were making a big difference in how these documents were put together.
Glad to hear that. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, please.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the board, one of the things I inadvertently left out of my executive director's report is related to our website. On or around August 10th, we will have a new website up, and the old one will no longer be out there, and it's going to have a significant different look and feel to it. I encourage you all to or staff or the general public to give us feedback, because we will be spending a lot of time in the upcoming months trying to update the content on the website. The website that will be rolled out on the 10th is simply the old site, but in a very new, with new functionality and a new feel to it. So that's going to be on August 10th, and we will present it to the board at our first opportunity.
Okay. Let's roll then to our overview of EQB statutory water responsibilities, and presenting will be Eric Dahl and Kate France. So, Eric? Or Kate? Or if you want to, whichever one's going first.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, my name is Kate France, and I'm EQB staff. So, today, what we're talking about. As executive director Seifert alluded to, we decided, based on a number of discussions on your part to re-engage on this issue of water governance programs in Minnesota. So we wanted to provide you with a little bit of background on where the EQB has been historically, as well as in recent history, why we're here today. So what we'll be talking about, what Eric and I will be handling today, I'll start with the Executive Order 1132. That's sort of our recent history on the water issues, the process and the recommendations that came out of that process. Eric will handle the statutory responsibilities that the EQB has, as well as one of those being the Minnesota Water Plan. And then we'll briefly touch on moving forward, what our role might be. And then that will move into the agency signature interagency presentations with our guest speakers today. So looking back to our statutes 116C, which covers the creation of the EQB, one of the duties that EQB has is under A here, that the board shall determine which environmental problems of interdepartmental concern to state government shall be considered by the board, and topics for investigation may include but need not be limited to water resources and quality. And of course, the statute goes on, but water resources and quality are specifically focused on in the statute. And similarly, the board shall review programs of state agencies that significantly affect the environment and coordinate those it determines are interdepartmental in nature and ensure agency compliance with state environmental policy. And that's where today's conversation starts, with several of those interagency programs. So from that statute, as we'll recall, the Executive Order 1132 was signed and put into effect, and Caroline mentioned that one of those projects under this executive order was regarding environmental review, but one of the other projects was related to the environmental report card, which was completed in November 2012, and that was a starting point for our citizen forums across the state and then our environmental congress. And one of the primary recommendations that came out of the water section of that congress was this right here: manage all the various regulations and competing priorities to have more effective and efficient management of water resources. And of course, this is a perennial concern that we've heard frequently. And this was also carried forward within the GICD recommendations that that Director Seifert alluded to, that once again, the GICD process picked up on this as one of the key points for EQB to move forward on. So with that, I'll let Eric talk a little bit about the statutes.
Thanks, Kate. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I'm going to walk through EQB statutes related to water as a refresher for the board. Staff provided a handout that I placed at your desks. It's also available on the table over there that lists in detail each statute related to EQB's water responsibilities. To start with, these three statutes recognize that the protection of surface and groundwater is vested in a multi-agency approach. EQB's statutory responsibility is to provide coordination of state groundwater protection programs and consolidate the assessments and policy reports from the EQB, MPCA, Department of Ag, DNR, Bowser, and Department of Health on surface water quality and quantity, groundwater availability, and degradation trends into a single report and submit it to the House and Senate committees with jurisdiction over the environment, natural resources, and agriculture. This report from 103A.43 is due every 5 years and comes due September 15, 2015. State Statute 103B.151 is the core of EQB's water statutes. It states that EQB shall, first, coordinate water resources and management among state agencies. Two, EQB shall coordinate comprehensive long-range water resource planning every 10 years. This is the state water plan, last completed in 2010. EQB shall coordinate and integrate state water planning and strategies across all levels of government, from local to regional to federal. EQB shall coordinate the development of state water policy recommendations and priorities, identifying funding needs, monitoring, prioritize the state water resources monitoring plan. EQB shall administer federal water resources planning with multi-agency interests. EQB shall ensure groundwater quality monitoring and related data is publicly available. EQB shall coordinate the development and evaluation of water information and education materials and resources, and EQB shall coordinate the dissemination of water information and education through existing delivery systems. So in 2010, as part of EQB's statutory responsibility, fulfilling 103B.151, a state water plan was completed and has been completed every 10 years since 1990. The most current version is the 2010, and it focused on defining a vision for Minnesota's water resources that ensures healthy ecosystems and meets the needs of future generations. It's comprised of three main components: reflecting on the past, which summarized key points from past decade planning efforts and presented significant issues and events that have influenced our understanding of natural resource priorities. Two, evaluating the status of Minnesota's water resources in the present. This section provided an overview of the status of the state's groundwater and surface water resources, as well as monitoring efforts and trends. And third, charting a roadmap for the future, implementation principles and strategies. This section is the foundation of the water plan, and it identified key strategies and principles for achieving the vision of sustainable water resources management. Now back to the statutes. 103A.403, the statewide nitrate data. This statute is that the EQB shall ensure that all available data regarding the presence of nitrates in groundwater in the state are integrated into the Minnesota Geospatial Information Office's statewide nitrate database. MinGeo, Department of Health, and Department of Ag hold this data and make it available via the public on their websites listed below. And the final statute is 473.1565, the Metropolitan Area Water Supply Planning Activities that shall be included in the Minnesota Water Plan, the 10-year plan. The Metropolitan Council carries out planning activities addressing the state water supply needs of the metropolitan area. This statute requires that the Metropolitan Council submit reports to the legislature regarding its findings, recommendations, and continuing water planning activities, and that these reports should be included in the 10-year water plan. So, getting back to today, the aforementioned statutes lay the baseline for EQB's role in water management and planning. In addition to EQB's role, other state agencies are involved in some amazing work related to water management and planning. EQB staff have been engaging with other agency staff related to water management and strategic long-range planning, and today's presentation set the stage for future presentations and discussions at EQB board meetings. Now back to Kate.
So as you listen to the discussions today, please consider where the potential role has been for EQB, what our current existing commitments are, including the ongoing Minnesota River work, which you've seen me present on in previous months, as well as the EQB 5 and 10-year planning reports that Eric just highlighted. But also think about what potential roles EQB could hold as well. We could carry forward some of the recommendations from the GICD report, but also think about perhaps the creative use of website and other media formats, or potentially holding a role as something like a clearinghouse for these great state initiatives that are already occurring. Within that framework, think about what level of priority these issues are for the board, and as well as what are the most compelling projects that we want to really take a look at. And then similarly, and probably most importantly, where can EQB add the most value without being duplicative of current efforts that are already ongoing? So with that, today you'll have four different programs discussed, one being the Water Governance Report, an update from the MPCA. DNR will be presenting the planning for groundwater sustainability in the 21st century Minnesota. Bowser is here to discuss One Watershed, One Plan, and the Department of Ag will provide an update on the implementation of the Minnesota Agricultural Water Quality Certification Program. And then, as Eric suggested, if there are additional efforts that you would like highlighted at future meetings, please let us know. We're happy to bring them in front of the board. And if you have other thoughts on what that potential role for EQB is moving forward in water planning, that's open for discussion as well. So with that, we'll take any questions you have for us.
Questions for Kate or Eric? Where is the Minnesota Geospatial Information Office located? And is it a living, breathing?
Mingeo is, Mr. Chair, members of the board, Mingeo is located within Minute, previously of the Department of Administration.
Okay.
It exists.
It does exist.
Third floor of COB.
And so the Department of Ag is involved in nitrate study. So is it the job of the EQB to make sure that the results of that study, well water study, are incorporated then into the database at this office? Somebody is supposed to ensure it says that happens.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, I think that's one of the questions of who exactly does that. Since EQB staff have been very limited in recent years, that's not a routine staff thing that EQB staff have handled, but I believe that other staff through other agencies have continued to keep that up.
So it's frightening to see all of the legislative requirements that the EQB is supposed to carry out, isn't it? Right. That may be a little strong language, maybe. Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Suzanne? Welcome to the board.
I just love to point it out. It's such a hideous world.
Suzanne, maybe you can introduce yourself for the record. And
yes, I'm Suzanne Reese. I'm currently, I have been for about 4 years now with DNR. Right now, I am in the land use programs of the Division of Ecological and Water Resources, and I specialize in floodplain management, among other things. The lead-in to this presentation, in 2012, I was formerly in the Parks and Trails Division, but I had this great opportunity to work through 2012 half-time for the PCA on this project, and it was a graduate-level seminar in water governance, which, you know, can't buy that sort of thing. Let's see. How does the remote work?
Just like that.
Yep. Okay. So I'm here to give you some background on the original 2013 water governance evaluation. As I said, it was prepared in 2012, came out early in 2013, and then we followed up at the beginning of this year with a short update report, and now we're kind of, I think it's another question for the EQB as to where that initiative will go. I'm also going to focus to some degree on the sort of timeline of water governance in Minnesota, because it's really essential to understand that, including the EQB's role in it, to understand the progression, how the state governance system has evolved the way that it has. So what prompted this study? This was a piece of legislation that was passed during the 2011 special session. And I think it resulted from, there was some concern at the legislature about how water was being managed across the state agencies. And there had been a number of reports in previous years. There was the Water Sustainability Framework from the university, report from the Freshwater Society, report from the Citizens League, and a number of them were fairly critical of how water was being managed, and they point to the inconsistencies in the agency missions and their enabling laws and the sort of complicated patchwork of local governments, watershed districts, watershed management organizations, declining local government capacity, both as a function of reduced local government aid and just the recession in general, and this complexity kind of breeding confusion and mistrust. So I think the thought behind this study was that these were all outside assessments. This is an opportunity to examine and develop recommendations from within the executive branch. Come on now. Okay, so this complicated slide just gives you a sense of some of the complexity of water management functions across the many agencies. And this is by no means complete. I think we list most of the state agencies, some of the regional agencies. There isn't room on the slide for all the local entities, but there are at least over 250 local units of government, including counties, cities, soil and water conservation districts, et cetera, that are involved in water management. There are WMOs, there are special purpose boards, there are many water-related nonprofits such as Ducks Unlimited, for example, or Isaac Walton. So a whole host of entities and a whole host of functions. And this is the timeline that I mentioned. This is you'll see some of this in the material that we sent out in advance. There's kind of a complete timeline table that tries to trace water-related legislation at the federal level and the state level, and some of the resulting studies that were either directed by the legislature or started from the executive branch, starting in 1893. And it's interesting, kind of from a big picture perspective, drainage came first. It was, you know, it's a wet state, as we learned especially last month. It kind of reverted back to its wetter condition. And a lot of it was just about draining wasteland, you know, swampland for agriculture. But then very shortly afterwards, there was legislation dealing with the public nature of public waters and riparian rights. And at very soon thereafter, the recognition that these public waters were essential to the state's economy for recreation as well as commerce. So thus the establishment of the Department of Conservation, now the DNR. Then came drought, the 1930s, the Depression, the Dust Bowl, the recognition that soil was an important resource, and the establishment of soil conservation districts. I should have mentioned that along the lower half of the slide, you can see the federal laws, and along the top, you can see the state laws. And so the next era after that was really that of pollution, recognizing how badly the waters were polluted and the efforts to clean them up. And this is kind of the era of sweeping environmental legislation from the 1960s through the mid-70s, often mostly initiated at the federal level and then followed at the state level. So, for example, NEPA going to MEPA and MIRA, the Minnesota Acts, the Clean Water Act, National Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, also being followed by action in Minnesota, and the Critical Area Act. And as we move ahead later into the 70s, you'll see that the state regulations begin to dominate. I mean, there were lots of amendments to the Clean Water Act. There were other sort of many adjustments over the years. But this is where we also begin to see some consolidation and streamlining, because it was clear even as early as the 70s that water management was divided among many, many agencies. So the establishment of Bowser through the merger of three other boards and the creation of the Clean Water Partnership Program. The Groundwater Protection Act in 89 was also a landmark. And then in the 90s, you see the recodification of all the water laws into Chapter 103. I say all, it's probably not all. And the Wetland Conservation Act in 91. There were efforts over the years to do water unification. This was under former Governor Ventura in 99. But probably the most important on this chart, and this closes out the timeline, is the Clean Water Legacy Act of 2006 and, of course, the Legacy Amendment of 2008. And what's interesting, I was looking back at this today, and EQB does play a very important role during this entire period. I looked at the references in the original 2013 report, and there are over 20 reports by EQB in there. Some of them are the water plans. There are a variety of other working papers. Plus, EQB worked very closely with then State Planning Agency, otherwise known as Minnesota Planning, which no longer exists. So back to 2012, this just highlights some of the other activities that were going on at the time. And these are actually, these are many of the same things that you'll be hearing more about today, the Ag Water Quality Certification, One Watershed, One Plan, and, of course, the EQB's own governance study and Environmental Congress. The project, as I mentioned, was led by the PCA, but we also had a very active work group of the five state agencies with the primary water-related responsibilities, as well as the Metropolitan Council. We surveyed agency staff and partners. We had some internal review. And what did the group decide? Basically, if you look at the history of water governance, it has always been kind of not fragmented, but it's been dispersed across the state and across the state agencies. There have been a series of studies, roughly one per decade, I think, that have called for better coordination and synchronization and even structural reform. But the other important takeaway is that since the Clean Water Act and the Legacy Amendment, coordination has been improving steadily, although gaps and inefficiencies remain. At least among our work group, there was no appetite for major structural reform, but rather for a series of targeted improvements. And those were the recommendations that we came up with. We have structural recommendations across three levels of government, state, regional, and local. And then, and just to very briefly try to summarize those, starting at the bottom at the watershed scale, this is where you see the One Watershed, One Plan initiative. The idea that we discuss in the report is, how do you define essential watershed management services? What are they, and how can you ensure that there's the capability of meeting them? At the regional scale, we look at those regional coalitions that are very effective at delivering water management. A couple that come to mind, the Great Lakes Regional Initiative, St. Louis River Area of Concern, and the Red River Watershed Board. But we don't think that those can be necessarily imposed from the state level. And then at the state, I think the goal is to continue to move to a more synchronized approach. I'll come back to that in a minute. We have resource-oriented recommendations in four primary areas. Public waters and wetlands. How do you improve? This is one of the real kind of black holes of regulation, where you get a tremendous amount of overlap, including with the Corps of Engineers. How do you improve the alignment of the statutes and the rules and the classifications of wetlands? Groundwater management, which you'll also be hearing more about, land use and water management, and then landowner and occupier efforts. And that's where we talk about the agricultural sector and about soil health. So our final report was submitted to the legislature in January of 2013. There were no hearings. We certainly presented it at many other locations and to many interested parties, but I don't think any direct action resulted at the legislature, although this year they did reactivate the Legislative Water Commission. I don't know if there's any relationship there. But the work group continued to meet and had, I guess it continued to meet up till around February of this year, to identify what was being implemented, what initiatives were either completed or were in progress, what new initiatives had emerged, and what are the issues that are in need of further direction or legislative action. and I think we met about 6 times. So that is encapsulated in the short update report, which came out in April of 2014. So I will just highlight a couple of the main points in that report and then open it up for any discussion or questions. Okay, so probably the most significant example of interagency coordination is the watershed approach. And this was originally developed at the PCA as a way to comply with the Clean Water Act requirements and accelerate TMDLs and implement restoration and be predictable and systematic. The idea is that and I'm sure you're familiar with this, that every watershed in the state would be monitored and planned for on a 10-year cycle. Now, the relationship, that cycle has kind of evolved into an interagency coordination system in which many of the state water management agencies play a role. So, and this is largely managed by the Clean Water Fund Interagency Coordination Team. Actually, I've got a little arrow there. The arrow highlights that first, it's a cycle. It begins, perhaps you could say that it begins with the monitoring and assessment over on the right, gets into the watershed characterization and problem implementation, the RAPS, which is the strategy development, the watershed plan, which is where the local role comes to the fore, and then the implementation of that plan through a variety of agency and other programs and funding mechanisms. Among the other activities, I can't cover everything that the interagency coordination team does, but among the progress that's being made in this area, you have the water portal. You have a consolidation and better dissemination of water-related data, both to the general public and among the agencies. The other major initiative, which I know Jason will talk more about, that has probably moved ahead the furthest, based on a lot of interest at the legislature, is groundwater management. And I probably don't need to say too much about that. A lot of it is in the groundwater strategic plan that the DNR has put together with its partners. But I will mention that between DNR and the Department of Health, the water appropriations and the well construction approval, which was a really great example of poor coordination and sort of a mismatch of permitting, has now been at least partially integrated. And that there's another work group that is working on water reuse across the various agencies. And then just to highlight a few of the reports that have come out and some of the programs that have come out in actually 2013-2014, we have the Ag Water Quality Certification Pilot Areas. We have a whole host of Bowser programs, the Nitrogen and Surface Waters Draft and the Nutrient Reduction Strategy from the PCA. And then at DNR, ongoing work on realigning the public waters wetlands and the whack-out wetlands, trying to get a shoreline protection grant off the ground and continuing to try to tease out the relationship between shoreland and drainage buffers. So to conclude, I think you can look at this whole sort of spectrum of or timeline of water governance activities as perhaps at least 2 eras up till now. Going back to the idea that you started with drainage and then conservation, recreation, public water, riparian rights, water pollution, water appropriation, all going up through the 70s. Perhaps the second phase has really been how to better share responsibility among the agencies, how to better integrate all these programs. And now we're going to decide if phase 2 is going to continue or if there will be a third phase. This gets to the future direction of this water governance work. It was a PCA-initiated effort, largely under the auspices of Commissioner Stein. The Clean Water Fund Interagency Coordination Team continues to play a role. They don't cover all the agencies, and they're not a particularly public forum, but they are very effective within this internal sort of administrative branch. And then the role of the EQB kind of remains open for discussion.
Thank you, Suzanne. Lots of information. Interesting timelines also.
Yes.
Questions? John.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and thanks, Suzanne. Great presentation, and of course, I love the project. The project. 100 different ways has been my entire career, and so I will just say three things. First of all, why do this? Because every legislature, maybe even the legislature that Dave Fredrickson was a part of, has said, these state agencies are all screwed up. There's too many of them doing too many different things.
I did not say that.
Yep. But it's always come up. But let me, that's my first point. The second point is that was by design.
Kate.
By design, the laws that govern the state were built upon and augmented in the 70s based on a very informative memo that we found from then staffer to Governor Levander, Dave Durenberger. Who said that we could organize water governance in the state a variety of different ways. We could seek a more integrated approach in which one central authority would have kind of all-knowing, all-seeing power about data, about management responsibility, and about funding, and about regulation, which, by and large, is what Wisconsin did. Wisconsin organized itself kind of around one central organization called their DNR, which is a combination of PCA, parts of Bowser, and DNR in Minnesota. Minnesota, though, based on Durenberger's recommendation to Governor Levander, implemented laws that kept a dispersed competitive model where interests around water would be driven from a public health perspective for drinking water, a pollution control perspective around water quality, a water quantity perspective around DNR, and a variety of other responsibilities for soil and water conservation at various boards at the time, and then agricultural use being the Department of Agriculture. So this model that we have was put in place with intent. Love it or hate it, it was designed to be this way. Then came along the role of the EQB to kind of weave the strands into something. The agencies and EQB have struggled over the years, I would say. And it's time to think about how we think about that going forward. So thanks for ending with that, Suzanne. And my last point is, if you think this is a mess, you should ask other states. We are the envy of every other state in the nation for our system of funding water management and governance in Minnesota. And I would say because local governments have built water plans and implemented them effectively at the local government level, much more so than they have elsewhere in the country. So I don't want to lose sight of the fact that even though it's complicated, it performs very well if you compare us against any other state in the nation. Our water quality outcomes, our water quantity outcomes, and our implementation practices are viewed by other states as significantly successful. Now, there's lots of room for improvement, and that's why we have this conversation. Those are my, as I said, I love the study. Suzanne, great job.
Thank you.
Other comments or questions? I served in the legislature in the last century, and I'm looking here, and I was part of the establishing Bowser, also the Groundwater Protection Act of 89. I was there during the recodification of the water laws and the Wetland Conservation Act. So I'll just take responsibility for those four. Yeah, not credit, just responsibility. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I had one question about the water sustainability framework that was done for the University of Minnesota. I know that some of the agencies were part of that. I'm struggling to figure out how that fits in, because I think it was in the same time frame, that 2010, 2011 time frame.
It predates it, and there was very heavy agency involvement. It was funded by the legislature, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it was intended to be an independent assessment where the agencies were sharing information and participating in formulating recommendations, but it was definitely an independent assessment. Some of the recommendations have been implemented and others may not be. I think the Legislative Water Commission was one of the recommendations.
Okay, and so it doesn't have really any standing with any of the anywhere. It's something that is just informative.
It's a foundational document.
Yeah, and some of those subgroups, they've had very creative subgroup reports.
Yeah. Yeah, we drew on it heavily, too. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Brian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to thank Commissioner Stein for that explanation. I hope I can remember that the next time somebody asks me why this is so confusing, that it was designed that way with a purpose and you're living the dream. I do have a question, though, and I'm not sure who this question is for, but the last question there is the role of the EQB. We've just reviewed the legislation. The role of the EQB is to coordinate public water resource, coordinate comprehensive long-range planning, coordinate. Why are we asking the question? It's in legislation. It either seems as if we're not forcefully fulfilling our role, or, you know, there was a while there we thought we were moving towards obsolescence, and we've re-engaged ourselves. But it seems to me that we shouldn't like to see that question there. We should know that our role is what the legislature stated our role is, and It just shouldn't be a question. I guess it's more of a comment than a statement.
Well, whose words are those? Yours, Suzanne?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, I think a lot of that is drawn from, the recommendation in the Governor's Institute report was that EQB should assume a greater role. I think the reason the role was in question had to do with the kind of eclipse of the EQB during the mid-2000s, that it didn't have the staff to fulfill those functions. And thus, I think, you know, PCA was responsible for producing this study, and during that, at that point, EQB was in such a state of transition that it really wasn't able to participate. But now the reinvigorated EQB is perhaps ready to assume that role.
I guess just to follow on, Mr. Chair, I'm pleased to see that the activities continue. You've cited the Department of Health and the DNR is working together to streamline the appropriations and well drilling process. It seems like the activity is going as planned, but that's not something I recall ever coming before the EQB as either a reported accomplishment or a project that was under consideration. So if we're to be coordinating all of these efforts, it would just seem that we should be aware of that having been a project that was under consideration, it was accomplished, and works, you know, it's underway.
Ed?
Isn't it a little bit about where we put our priorities and our energy? I mean, a lot of it, the water stuff is really working really well, and a lot of other places it may not be working as well. So we have some oversight as an EQB, but where do we want to put our attention for places that aren't working as well, where you need a little bit more work? Because there's still is limited staff, there's still is limited time. Where, so I think, you know, as we have this presentation, we see what's working, what's not. Then where do we focus our attention with this board?
You know, and to add to that, the timing of this particular agenda item is ironically coincides, but it's not really ironic because it was intentional, coincides with the biennial budget preparation. And as we rethink what our role should be going forward, it should help us inform what we ask the legislature to fund. And so...
You've got that wrinkle in your forehead, which means you're really cogitating on something. Tom Landwehr.
Fell asleep on my binder.
Yeah, that worried look.
It comes with the job.
Yeah, okay. All right, any other comments or questions? Kate, what part of this do you want to take your responsibility for? I mean, you looked at that timeline, didn't you?
Oh, he's calling you out as a former legislator. Yeah. That's what he's doing.
Oh, Mr. Chair, we got a bunch of money to work on water when I was at the legislature.
Nice comeback.
With the help of many wonderful citizens who worked very hard to pass that amendment. And that 2011 budget passed during special session, I can't claim to have voted for most of it.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Suzanne. Our next item on the agenda is Jason. And Jason is going to be here from the DNR to background us on groundwater sustainability in the 21st century. Jason, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the board. I hope Tom's worried look was because he was not because he was anticipating what I might say today. The title for this presentation, and this presentation has been delivered at least, I've lost count, maybe about 12 times in various forums and venues with various degrees of emphasis on different parts and pieces. So I hope I've hit the mark on what I've chosen to emphasize here and the examples I'll use to illustrate. But I want to talk about the title for a moment, and that is the planning for groundwater sustainability. I like a definition of planning that is translating knowledge into action. And Suzanne had mentioned variety of different planning efforts that have brought us to where we are today. One of those that she mentioned is that the DNR put together a draft strategic plan for us as an organization, set the direction. Where do we think we need to go given the mandate and the charge from the legislature? And so what I'm going to start with in this presentation is a snapshot of what we think is our understanding, our knowledge about our water resources, and primarily what I'm going to focus on is the quantity side of the question. But certainly there's a relationship here to quality. I won't talk a whole lot about that. But how that is informing our actions in terms of what additional information we get, but also what sort of efforts we've been undertaking over the last year or so, a couple of years now. It seems to go very quickly. So that explains a bit of the title and why it's set up that way. There's really sort of three elements to this presentation. One is, and I want to emphasize this, the problem that we're talking about is the risk of overuse and contamination of our water. And I will just remind everybody that 75% of Minnesotans rely on groundwater to meet our drinking water needs and other public water supply needs. But it's the risk that we're focusing on. I'm going to emphasize largely DNR's role, and I'll speak a little bit to that last topic that Suzanne, or one of the topics Suzanne had mentioned about coordination with the Department of Health, because I think this is a tremendous developing success story that happened fairly quickly. And then I'm going to wrap it up by talking about what our approach has been, what we've been doing over the last year or so, and I'm certainly not going to cover the full gamut of things, but just give you sort of a high-level view of where we're emphasizing and putting our energy, and then maybe that helps you to think about, as you're thinking about, where's the EQB role. So understanding the risk. This is how we're understanding it. This is my only water quality slide, but obviously nitrate is showing up in groundwater, and it's showing up in what tend to be concentrated places. It's not just everywhere, and so we're learning more about that, and we're learning, obviously, in the Department of Agriculture is the lead on actions to try to address that from agricultural sources. But the other element of this is water use. And so what this represents is a trend line of our water use. This is statewide groundwater use. And what's essentially being shown here is that over a period of 25 years, we're using about 3 billion gallons more groundwater each year, year after year. So overall, on average, about 75 billion gallons more than we were 25 years ago. Suzanne's timeline pointed out that the history of Minnesota was that water was not only unlimited, but sort of the evil, and we had to drain it and get rid of it. Well, we're obviously recognizing a much more nuanced picture of water in the state of Minnesota. This is a very sort of overarching view that we're using more. But by itself, it just tells us, you know, our population is growing and we're using more water for a variety of things. It doesn't really tell us that there is a problem in any particular location. We start to drill down a little bit, and if we look at what's changed, this is from the Twin Cities area, and we look at how we've met our water supply needs in the Twin Cities and how that's changed over time. So on the far left of this graphic, you're looking at in the 1940s, the majority of our water supply in the Twin Cities was met with surface water sources, the Mississippi River. What this really represents is that Minneapolis and St. Paul were the big show in town. That's where most of the population was, and they rely on surface water. Both those communities still heavily rely on surface water. But as the suburbs have grown and our population has grown, we've gone to groundwater sources. Lots of good reasons. Economics, one of the main one, and that is that it's a lot cheaper to drill a vertical pipe than it is to lay horizontal pipe. You don't have to get as much permission from land to move water across the land as you do to just pull it up. The other is that the quality of the groundwater underneath the Twin Cities is generally very high, except for the places where we've contaminated it. And it requires very little treatment. So it's an extremely cost-effective approach. And I think the numbers that I've heard is that the surface water costs are about 4 or 5 times more than the groundwater. So if your community relies on surface water, you're spending about 4 or 5 times more to get that water to a drinking water standard than you do if you're in groundwater, just to give some sense of that. So we're now relying heavily on groundwater to meet our water supply needs here in the Twin Cities. But we also know that as we pull groundwater out of, out of the ground, the amount that we pull, the distribution of how we pull it, the rates, et cetera, and the materials we're pulling it from have some consequences. We're pulling it out of storage, if you will. And this picture just is a very simple graphic to illustrate that as we pull water up a pipe, we create these cones of depression. So you can imagine all of the appropriations all around the state, all these pipes are creating, some cases, very small little cones of depression that might not even be measurable, to in some cases, very large cones of depression that we can see reflected in adjacent water bodies or nearby wells. So one of the challenges we have as an agency is when we grant somebody, and I can't point to the other side of this, but when we grant somebody a permit, to use more than 1 million gallons in a year, that's when you need a permit from the DNR. When we grant them the ability to do that, we have to make sure that that use is not going to result in, like this picture shows, an interference with that domestic well. So somebody nearby, is their well going to go dry now because of this permitted use? Or are we having an effect on a surface water nearby? So these are the risks that we're growing to understand. And so as we're using more water, we're understanding that we're at a greater risk potentially. And as we've drained the landscape, how has that changed the way that the water is residing and how it's moving and all these things in storage stuff, etc. Complex picture. About a year ago now, we put this map together, and what we did was evaluate every monitoring well that we had 20 years of data for. These are what we call observation wells. They're just pipes in the ground and they measure water level. They're measuring sometimes deep aquifers, sometimes shallow aquifers. Those are represented by the shape of the figure here. But the point that I want to emphasize is one that I was making earlier, and that is that water is not distributed evenly around the state. So the first thing I would show you is the base map. The dark green represents the southwestern and western part of the state, much more of a clayey soil and much more limited deeper aquifers to meet water supply needs. Worthington, down in the southwestern part of the state, they've got limited aquifers, and they're really struggling to maintain an adequate water supply. Moorhead and other communities along the Red River Basin are in similar situation, and they're mixing and matching surface water, groundwater. So We get to central Minnesota, that lighter shade of green. This is primarily very deep sands, but it's glacial. There's clays. It's just a many years of glacial material and melt and back and forth. It's very complicated. We're trying to map that through our Atlas program. But generally speaking, there's pretty good aquifers throughout much of the part of the state. The northeast, the Arrowhead, doesn't have a whole lot for groundwater. The rock there is hard rock. It's not porous material. It doesn't really hold much water other than what resides in fractures and cracks and so forth. So it's not particularly productive, high yielding. The southeastern part of the state, which would be that sort of cream color and then the gold and then that orangish part, have a variety of deeper bedrock aquifers. They're very productive. They're generally of very high quality, but they also have water that's been there a very long time. So in the Twin Cities, much of the water that we're pulling out of the ground to meet our municipal water supply needs has been there for 20,000 years or more, which raises questions about how quickly is it recharging. What this graph illustrates with the gray boxes is that we analyzed all of these monitoring wells that we have, and we say, is there a trend in the water level that we've seen? Just a simple measure of trend. Is it going up? Is it going down? Or is it relatively stable? The gray indicates no trend, statistical trend. The yellow indicates a downward sloping trend over that 20-year time frame, and the blue indicates an upward sloping trend. And what you can see is that it's complicated. There's no one color showing up predominantly in any one part. You got gray and yellow right next to each other. Right in the Twin Cities, we've got blue, yellow, and gray all almost overlapping, which is a reflection of the complexity of these aquifers. But it is part of how we're beginning to understand how water levels are changing around the state. But what I would point out is that there are lots of places, many counties, that have no dots. And that's because we have a fairly inadequate network. This represents 296 sites. Our network today has about 950 wells in it. 20 years from now, we'll have good data at 950 locations around the state. We've estimated that we need as many as 7,000 wells with long-term data to really truly understand the complexity of these aquifers and the trends over time in these water levels and how it interacts with our surface water features. So we've got a long way to go. I'm going to just show you a little bit of the way this manifests here in the Twin Cities. So what you're seeing here is the airport. Hopefully you can recognize there in that far red circle right kind of in the middle of it, the big white stretch there without the road network. We're going to look at Richfield. We're going to look at Bloomington. We're going to look at Excelsior, and then we're going to look out at Orono and Lake Minnetonka area. And I'm going to show you some graphs of those areas because we happen to have some pretty good data from these places. So this is the Prairie du Chien aquifer water levels. This is the workhorse aquifer, if you will, for the Twin Cities. This is what a lot of communities rely on, not exclusively, but it's a big one. Very productive, good water quality. The blue line here represents the water levels over time. The red line represents water use within 5 miles. And there's nothing magic about 5 miles. It's just to kind of give you a picture. And that, excuse me, that corresponds with those red circles. So you'll see there is some overlap here. The simple point of this graph is that in this area, water levels are holding pretty steady. Now, that's this red circle that laser doesn't work. That's the one centered on Richfield. This is an area that's been developed for a long time. It's not really growing. In fact, their use is kind of flat or declining for the most part. And the water levels seem to be doing that same thing, maybe even going up a little bit. Slightly different picture when we look what's going on over in Bloomington. Here we see some downward trend, some flat, and then some downward trend again. To what degree the increase in use over the last decade or so is contributing to that downward trend, you know, we haven't analyzed that, but this is just how we're beginning to understand what is taking place. This is another one. Now here we are in Excelsior, slight downward trend, pretty steady upward trend over the last couple of decades. And this is the one that's maybe been the poster child for groundwater. This is our longest period of record. This is right underneath the, or right near the Minnetonka Boatworks in the city of Orono, Lake Minnetonka area. pretty steady downward trend, 60 years worth of downward sloping trend on the water levels of that aquifer. And then we see a period of decrease in water use, and then a more recent period over the last 15 years or so of pretty steady upward increase in water use. The mayor of Orono was attending a meeting that I was at talking about these trends and had come up to me and said, "We're very concerned about this," looking at this downward trend, which is my cue to say that we're tasked with managing water sustainably. And the question that we're struggling with is this an unsustainable trend in water level, or what will happen over time? If growth in this area levels off, if use levels off, will these aquifers start to reach a new equilibrium of recharge and withdrawal? This is the science that we're trying to actively explore without definitive answers. On the other hand, you know, if you're thinking about your community's water supply and you're trying to plan out for 10 or 20 years, this should be a fairly concerning signal that we're seeing, especially if the communities around you might also be growing or planning for some businesses that require water. So these are some of the things that we're sharing and trying to stimulate people to understand that perhaps water isn't as unlimited as we've thought about it in the past. The Met Council has been looking at this issue. They've done some modeling. This is an older one. And what they've done is look at the projected growth and water use, and they said, how might this water use trends be reflected in the surface water features in and around the metropolitan area? Really, what you would draw from this is that the darker the blue, the more vulnerable that surface water feature might be to the projected water use that the communities in that area would be using in 2050. That suggests that the wetlands up in the Anoka Sand Plain have some vulnerability. Many of the wetlands along the Minnesota River Basin have some vulnerability. Down in Dakota County, we have a trophy trout stream vulnerable. Various lakes, northern Washington County, you can see a series of shallow lakes and deeper lakes that show up there as being potentially vulnerable to projected increase in water use. They've recently updated their models. They're doing some more refining. And, you know, so we're continuing to learn here. But this is just, again, how we're beginning to understand the challenge, the issues. I mentioned the deep aquifers. One of the things we are blessed with here is multiple deep aquifers underneath the Twin Cities. This is a slice across the Twin Cities from west to east. I'm not going to try to give you hydrogeology 101 here, but what we recognize is that much of the recharge for the deepest aquifers of the Twin Cities is actually coming outside of the seven-county metropolitan area. Water that is ultimately getting into the Mount Simon, which is the deepest aquifer underneath the Twin Cities, is coming from the collar counties that are, you know, all the way along Sherburne, Wright, many of those areas, and specific areas within those counties that we've now mapped and defined as the recharge edge. Nice little video on YouTube if you like to check it out. It's not Hollywood production, but it's DNR production, and it's not bad. I think that's where I'll leave that. What we've understood more recently about the Mount Simon Aquifer is that every year we see a period of drawdown in the summer that reflects a lot about the way we use water in Minnesota, and that is a lot more water gets pumped out of the ground in the state of Minnesota in the months of June, July, and August. We like a green landscape, and we're going to make it green whether it rains or not. We haven't had to do a lot of that this year, but that's when our water use is the highest. And what we see is these kind of drawdowns, and this is reflected in the Mount Simon Aquifer. Certainly something to be paying attention to and thinking about. And so communities out in Carver County, for example, that you see that where they're dependent on the Mount Simon, in the western portion here, drawing it down right under the center of Hennepin County, we've got some drawdown. And as well up into Anoka County. But again, the recharge for these aquifers is not coming from above. It's coming from the west, by and large. The water is moving from the west down towards the rivers. So I'm going to talk about our role and responsibility at DNR. I'm going to focus on appropriation permits just quickly and well construction. So the legislature in 2010 passed several new statutes. I'm not sure who wants to take responsibility or credit at the table for these. But the legislature said, added some language in the statutes as part of a revision that the DNR is responsible for managing water sustainably, and they they provided some language about what sustainability meant. So I break it down because it's easier for me to follow it than the way statutes are actually written. Basically, what they say is when we grant somebody a permit to use water, we need to take into consideration current and projected water levels. So the kinds of things I just showed you, where we have that information, what would this use do? Would it exacerbate a problem? Would it be okay? Not an issue? That sort of thing. That's sort of a simple level. We also have to consider water quality. One of the ways that we deal with that is, for example, pollution, contamination. I'll use the 3M situation, the contamination below 3M waste site in Washington County. We want to make sure that when somebody appropriates groundwater, that they're not going to cause those contaminants to migrate. So pollution containment or keep, you know, so don't move it. Don't cause stuff to move and contaminate somebody else as well is one of the simple ways that we can think about how we interpret that responsibility. But then there's this protect the ecosystems and then future generations to meet their needs. So one of the most complex things that we have to wrestle with is the whole water cycle, water budget, what happens, drought years, wet years, and how does a wetland interact with the underlying aquifers? And how does that get influenced by pipes pulling water out of the ground? And how do we understand that? And that is really what we're spending a good deal of time at the DNR trying to wrestle with, trying to figure out, do we even have the right information across the state to be able to evaluate that? You know, and so as we've looked at sustainable use and as we're articulating it in this draft strategic plan, it's, you know, it needs to be a legal use. It needs to be reasonable. It's got to be for the things the legislature says you can use water. You can't cause an interference with somebody else as well. We can't have conflicts result from that use. We think we interpret this water level language as staying within some sort of recharge threshold. I mean, if you're pulling it out faster than it's recharging, ultimately you can't do that forever. And then the adverse impacts to surface water, and then how do we deal with this water quality issue? And that's a complicated one. I'm not going to get in a lot here today, but I think that's one area that the EQB can help us as agencies explore, because there's health has a role, ag has a role, DNR has a role. This is an area that is ripe for further discussion. So the way that we're articulating this is that somewhere in here, there are thresholds for how much water we can use. And those thresholds could be defined by a surface water impact. It could be defined by an interference issue. It could be defined by a water quality problem. It could be defined by all three of those in any one location around the state, or only one of those in any one location around the state. But as we increase our use over time, the message is clear. Somewhere in here are thresholds. We believe the responsibility that we have from the legislature is to figure out where those thresholds are and manage the appropriations within those. One of the things that helps us with that is the new law that was passed last year, and that is that prior to this law, if you wanted to drill a well in the state of Minnesota, you notified the Department of Health and you filed a fee of $285 and you went out and drilled the well. You filed your report afterwards, what you drilled through and where the water was, et cetera, and fill in information. Well, when you drill a high-capacity well, you ultimately have to get a permit from the DNR. And what we were finding is that people were drilling wells in locations where we weren't able to give them the amount of water that they were requesting in their permit. And we raised this issue in the legislature. It was identified in the report that we worked on as agencies and said, you know, there's something really backwards about this. What if these individuals had some information ahead of time that at least gave them the idea that there might be some issues here? So before you spend $60,000 on your irrigation well and the equipment and you've got it sitting on site and you're waiting for your permit only to find out, maybe not a good investment, right? That seemed to make sense. They passed the law. And for the last year now, we've been evaluating people's proposed wells, trying to give them the best information that we can about what we know in that area, and we do it in generally about 3 days or less from the time they notify us. We give them a turnaround and say, this is likely to meet the needs, or likely to meet the needs, but there's limited information in the area. We may need to require some monitoring or some other kind of testing, so just so you know, if you're going to make this investment, you may have some other costs. Frequently, they had not been apprised of that kind of information at all beforehand. And in some cases, we've sent letters back saying, We think it's very unlikely that you'd be able to get an appropriation permit for the requested amount of water in the requested aquifer that you've identified. Sometimes we're able to direct them to a different aquifer where we think it wouldn't be an issue, and sometimes we're not. We've done about 450 of these preliminary assessments in the last year, and then we get the permits. Most of those have been cautionary sort of letters, you know, you may need to do this testing or so on and so forth. We've had a little over a dozen, I think, letters where we've said not likely to meet the needs here. Out of 450, about a dozen.
Jason, does that end it there, or is there a process where the person requesting the permit would move forward, or is that generally has ended it right there? Let's say if you say, I'm sorry, but, you know, doesn't look like there's enough water to service your needs?
Chair Fredrickson, it's a great question. Usually what we do is we say, get in touch with us because maybe we can steer you here a little bit. And that's been the case in several examples. Or sometimes it's just that starts the conversation of, well, do you really need that much water? Maybe if you could you get by with less? Then we think maybe it's an okay situation. But that is not the equivalent of a permit. That's still just our assessment to them. There's nothing that stops them from drilling the well, but they're taking on that risk with the information that we've given them.
Well, if you don't give them the permit, they're not going to.
Well, but this is just our assessment. This is not actually the permit. This is just a 3-day, here's what we know in the area. They drill the well, then they come in and say, okay, I'd like to get my permit. And if they've gotten a letter from us that said this is unlikely to meet, and they continue to proceed, and they request a permit, now at least we said, we tried to get, and we haven't had that situation for the most part. Okay. We've been able to steer this. You know, it's still new, and we're still evolving it, but for the most part, we haven't had it. We've had 5 denials on permits in the last year out of 500 or so permits, so it doesn't happen very often. Just real quick, our role of understanding sustainability, we're really talking about now better understanding what's happening with lakes and wetlands in terms of the water levels, also the groundwater in that area, streams and rivers, because that's water that's moving through the system. So this is a sort of a water budget, if you will, kind of an analysis. But really the analysis that we have to focus in on is this relationship of the surface waters and the groundwaters. For the most part, we don't think that we're at risk of violating safe yield for the aquifers, meaning where you really jeopardize the aquifer's ability to produce water, where the wells actually fail. That's a pretty significant consequence. We're not at a very high risk of that. There's been some instances of that, but for the most part, that's not going to be the main concern. The main concern is probably going to manifest itself as water quality issues or impacts to surface waters or, more frequently, interference with other users. Those things tend to show up sooner than issues with aquifer sustainability yield itself. I'm not saying it won't happen. It's just more likely not to be based on what we're understanding. So our approach, given our evolving understanding of our aquifers and the trends that we see for water use, has been to focus on the sustainability mandate to really dramatically improve the information that we can have available to us to make these kinds of decisions. And we're playing catch up because trend information is what's most valuable. And you can't make up trend information. You only can start it when you start it. You can't go back and recreate it. And then also to engage our stakeholders, and I'll just talk briefly about that in a moment. So the strategic plan lays out 7 core strategies that we think are important for us to fulfill this mandate, and one has been to heighten priority. We think we've been doing that. We've been out talking about these issues. The legislature certainly helped us by inviting us to talk about it, but we need to continue to do that because there is still very much a mindset that water is unlimited, and as Suzanne illustrated or talked about earlier, we're in a very wet period right now, and there's a whole lot of people thinking, all right, we're good. We're out of the woods, right? We got high water all over the place. We've got too much water on Lake Minnetonka. You can't go fast right now. But that's not universally true, and it doesn't mean the aquifers have all recharged after periods of years. We need to enhance the information. I've talked about that. We're making those investments, but we need to continue to do so. We're also trying to improve the way that we're managing appropriation permits. One of the things I didn't say earlier, and I'll do it now, is that we issue permits for anybody that uses more water than 1 million gallons per year or 10,000 gallons per day. But these permits have been issued over a period of 60 years. So somebody's got a permit from 60 years ago that's in the family. It's rarely ever revisited. And one of the things that we're looking at is now as we see this intensifying use of groundwater in geographic locations, it brings into question, well, what's the cumulative impact of that use, not just the individual use and the new appropriation? So we're taking a look at methodologies to better understand cumulative impact, especially in places where we don't have monitoring wells, which is so much of the state. How do we understand that cumulative use where we don't have any indication of what's happening with the water levels? What are we going to do? So we're working on that. That's an active area of our staff's work right now. We've been incredibly successful in improving the compliance with permits and regulations, much to our own demise. We reviewed air photos and identified quite a few number of irrigation situations that did not seem to be permitted. We sent them letters. We got their attention, and now they're applying for permits. And we don't have the staff to process all those permits, and we're having a hard time meeting our 150-day goal as a result of that. But nevertheless, we are taking good, decisive action and making progress and getting people into compliance. We're working on improving our communication. I think the first presentation that Amy gave you of plain language has been the model for us as well that we're struggling with. So resumes would be certainly welcome. You know, this is complicated stuff. You know, and just as what I've illustrated today, you struggle to keep people's attention through a lot of this material, but we need to get this kind of information out there in ways that people can understand. But we're also focusing on the places that we're seeing the most intensive use, where we think there are more pressing problems. We've avoided the use of the term crisis because we're really not in a crisis, but we do have some problem areas, places where our growth in water use is higher than in other places. The Bonanza Valley in central Minnesota is an example. It's 178% more water use now than it was 25 years ago. In the metropolitan area, we're seeing some intensive use. There's other places like that, and that's where we're focusing. We're also focusing in the places where there are just very limited aquifers and communities that would like to grow and develop and have commerce and things that depend on water, and they're struggling with being able to find long-term water supply to meet those needs. So we're focusing on those geographies. And then along the way here, we're trying to emphasize conservation, that we could solve many of these problems or potential problems if we figured out how to use the water a little bit more wisely, a little more conservatively. And there is a statute that says the Department of Natural Resources shall develop a water conservation allocation and development program. And we're taking that responsibility seriously, and we're trying to scope now what that program could and should look like as we're now better understanding our water availability and needs. I mentioned focus areas. This is probably not news to anybody, but we've established these three areas of the state where we're developing groundwater management areas. These are the working boundaries that we've started out with. We've had stakeholder meetings. These started last October for the one in the North and East Metro. The other two started in January. We've got some very productive advisory teams assembled. We're adding some members to those advisory teams as a result of some legislation that passed last year that requires that at least a majority of the teams be made up of permitted stakeholders. So we've got local units of government on there and other agencies that really don't have permits, so we're bringing on people that have permits so that we're getting a good mix there. So we'll be adding some more folks. In each of these three pilot areas, we're engaging these stakeholders. We're asking them to help us to think about what we can do in those geographic areas to enhance the information, to heighten the awareness, to improve our decision-making, to improve on education. These strategies, what can we do here? Here's our ideas. What do you think? What could we do different? What could we do better? Many of you have your staff from your agencies are on these advisory teams or regularly attending, participating with us, and we're coordinating that through our interagency groundwater and drinking water team to make sure that we're very well integrated in that as a nod to how we're continuing to get better in our approach. So we're seeking their advice. We're trying to increase the transparency. A lot of people don't understand how it is that we make these decisions, what data we use to analyze them, and what the responsibilities are. So we're trying to increase, you know, people's awareness and understanding of that. We anticipate having some draft plans developed for each of these areas over the next few months that we'll get public input on. And then the idea is that we would implement those plans over a number of years. I want to emphasize that this plan and these groundwater management area plans are largely plans for DNR. It's what we think we need to do. At the same time, what we might do and will do will inform what other people would do. But we're not trying to tell communities what they should do. We're trying to help inform them about what we're doing so that they can make informed decisions about how they want to go about this. Let me give you an example. In the North and East Metro, the city of Woodbury and DNR have been trying to work through some issues with permitting some groundwater wells that we think have the potential to impact the trout stream. And we went and explained to them what we're doing with the groundwater management area, and we talked about our overall concerns about sustainability and trends, et cetera. And we said, we're not trying to do your planning for you. We're not going to tell City of Woodbury you need to go connect to Maplewood or St. Paul to get your water. But what we're trying to tell you is that there's information that indicates that the trends aren't pointing in the right direction and that your community wants to grow, you're expected to grow, and you're anticipating growth, and you're likely to use more water. Well, subsequent to those conversations, the City of Woodbury has done a number of things to try to figure out how they can maintain their water management autonomy. It's valuable to the City of Woodbury that they don't depend on somebody else. So they're looking at all kinds of things they can do to not increase the amount of water they need to pump from groundwater. That got stimulated as we began discussions about this groundwater management area. And so that's the sort of thing, as we get out, talk about specific communities and what's going on, we're already seeing this sort of response in the system. Okay, so this is what this is about. We need to start planning for a long-term future. City of Woodbury has invested in stormwater construction facilities. They're taking water from pavement, putting it into ponds on a golf course, and now using that water to irrigate the golf course rather than pulling up this 20,000-year-old water that's of high quality that can be darn near drinkable when it comes out of the ground to put that on the lawn, right? These kinds of innovations, and I'm getting ahead of myself because this is what I'm talking about, is that the idea is we understand what the sustainable limits of use are in a particular geography, then the people that are using the water and doing the planning for water use can start to innovate in the ways that make sense in that geography. In some cases, that might be, hey, we're going to figure out how to just use less. We don't have any other options. This is the only way we can do it, folks. We have to use less. Or maybe it's like here in the Twin Cities. Geez, we got a couple of big rivers that go through here. There's a lot of water flowing through those rivers. What if we use that a little bit more and less dependence on groundwater? That's an active conversation. Met Council is doing a bunch of studies, working with communities on how that might play out. Shared systems. Maybe if we share across, we can deal with some of these sustainability concerns, take some pressure off of certain areas that might be having surface water impacts, for example. This is a big one, leak detection. It's largely going it's interesting. There are a lot of communities that have aging infrastructure or old infrastructure. And 30-40% of the water that they pump out of the ground, treat, and distribute to their customers gets lost on the way. Never makes it to its destination because it leaks out. Now, it's not necessarily lost from the system because it's still generally residing in the groundwater, but it nevertheless is very expensive to do that because pumping costs energy. And maybe you're pulling up deep water and you're not getting it back down where it is, you know, from the deep aquifer. So there are some issues there. A quick anecdote. I recently heard about the City of Burnsville doing an analysis of where their carbon footprint was for the city. I mean, where did they produce carbon? What was the, you know, and they were trying to figure out what they could do about it. Half of the carbon dioxide that was produced from the City of Burnsville's operations came from their wells to pump groundwater. Well, so you start doing some math on that. Well, reduce my energy, save money, maybe the we got declining water levels there. So suddenly a number of positive things emerge if conservation becomes your focus, if you will. I've mentioned stormwater, and certainly there's been already some talk about reuse. And the notion of reuse, I want to distinguish between stormwater and reuse. Stormwater is water that was never conveyed in a pipe, really. It's not being reused. It's just getting used for something. Reuse is water that's been conveyed through a pipe and used, and now it's going to be used again. We have waste treatment facilities in the metropolitan area that by and large, water comes through our homes and our businesses. It gets used once, and it goes, it gets treated, and then it gets discharged to the Mississippi River. People are beginning to question the wisdom of that sort of an approach, and if we were to just cycle that water through one more time for something, maybe we wouldn't have as many of the issues or problems that we have. So there's studies and efforts. Met Council's got a project. They're treating water to drinking water standards, and it's available to be tapped and used, but it's now going to recharge groundwater in St. Francis, I believe it is. We've also talked about minimum management practice for agriculture, things like irrigation scheduling, so getting these folks to really only apply the amount of water that they need. They have incentives to do that already because it costs a lot of energy. It costs more in energy to irrigate than it does in the water appropriation fee that they pay for. So there's already some incentives there, but there are some tools and techniques in the Department of Agriculture. Minnesota DNR supported the development of a new position through Clean Water Fund that's at the university to help irrigators get the best information they can to help them with scheduling and only put on the amount of water they need. And, of course, then that goes along with nutrient management and crops issues as we get into some of these water quality, water use issues. All these things are going to be in play. We may not be able to grow the most water-intensive crops and the most nutrient-intensive crops everywhere and maintain sustainable water quality and sustainable water quantity. But those are the things that we're working on. One of the things, as we've talked about conservation, is the need to get some of the industries out there to be leaders in this. Golf course operators can be leaders for how to use water efficiently and meeting and using other supplies rather than us. You know, I mean, instead of us trying to solve all these things, if we can facilitate others to be sharing their information, City of Chanhassen has recently added radios all around the city. They can get water use readings from all of their customers every 15 minutes as opposed to the old once a month scenario. Every 15 minute analyzing that kind of data can tell you a lot about, does this home have a leaky toilet because it's just continuing to run high, or many leaky toilets? Are they pulsing so they're, you know, every other day for this many hours, it's irrigation? There's lots of things that can be learned from understanding how we're using water with good data like that. And a community, as they get that kind of data, can analyze it, share it with others. I think there's lots of opportunities here to develop on a sector-by-sector basis new ideas and innovations for how we can use water wisely. And we want to try to figure out how we can support that. All right, so I'm wrapping up. The three main ideas, again, are that the problem is we are at risk of overusing and contaminating, and we know we have examples of that. The role that we play is to really understand sustainability and try to help people plan for what might be sustainable over the long haul, and that we're focused on sustainability, engaging stakeholders, and making sure that more and more people understand and move from the paradigm of an unlimited water supply in the state of Minnesota to one that needs to be managed. We have a tremendous amount of water. It's a question of managing it. How do we use it? Where do we use it? And what do we do with it? And I'll take any questions.
Well, thank you. Again, highly informative. Questions, Ed? Comments?
We can tell if there's subsurface moisture on Mars. Don't we have better technology than drilling wells to determine water level? Isn't there some technology that we can use better than what we've got?
Commissioner Ellinger, there is, and we're exploring that. But it's also complicated because what's happening deeper below at the next level and the next level and the next, with these multiple aquifers, makes it difficult to discern, well, okay, if we're reading through the imagery that the water levels are wherever they are, say, in the surface, it still doesn't tell us about what's happening below that. So let me give you an example. In the Vermilion River in Dakota County, we have what we call a well nest. So we have a well that's in the surficial aquifer. That's the one that's right at the top, and it's really connected to the Vermilion River. Then we have one in the next aquifer below that. And what we find is that, well, they're related. And when one's going one direction, the other one does as well. And so they're leaky. And then we have another one in the next aquifer below that and the next aquifer below that. And so what we're understanding is better how these things are related. But we have very few of these kinds of well nests with very limited sort of long-term data with which to really understand what you're talking about, which, okay, how do you take big spatial data imagery like this and then interpret it and make sense of it in ways that you can feel a tremendous amount of confidence in?
It's just a challenge to use the technology that's
absolutely
there. The second question is, you know, we have DNR and Ag and Health all looking at wells. Do we adequately share enough information? Do we use all of those wells appropriately for all of the data collection that is done so that we can benefit from each other's activities?
Yeah, Commissioner Ellinger, great question. Thank you. Yes, we do. We're getting better and better at that. We're integrating our databases. And what we do now is that if we drill new wells, frequently we're drilling wells for the Department of Agriculture. But in any case, when any one of us is putting in monitoring wells, we have coordination to explore whether or not that well would meet any of the other agencies' needs for data and for purposes. The difficulty is that PCA has wells for contamination sites. Those aren't necessarily the kind of sites that we want to use for looking at water supply questions. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. The wells that Ag relies on for nitrate are frequently in the surficial aquifers, but we're also interested in deeper aquifers. So one of the things we're looking at is, well, can we use these to add like well nests? So yeah, okay, you've got one for the surficial, but we're going to add one for the deep. So we are coordinating extensively on that, and we share that information. All of that data is now going into an enterprise database that the agencies are committing to, and that is EQUIS. The PCA hosts that database. That's where the Department of Ag puts their data. The Department of Health is going to be putting their data in there, and they're working to get some of their old databases set up to be able to do that. And DNR is doing that as well with all of our county geologic atlas data. So some of it's a work in progress, but the you know where we're not doing it, the intent is to do it, and we've got projects underway to do it.
Commissioner Stein?
Commissioner Ellinger, too, one thing that is true behind the scenes that unless you work with the data all the time, the hydrologists all know that one well equals one unique identifying code in the state. That was one thing that happened thanks to U.S. Geological Survey and Minnesota Geological Survey a long time ago. And so one of the benefits of having unique identifiers on our data points is that we don't have conflicts over which well the data is actually from,
right,
which is held in common across Minnesota agencies. So you will not have sort of confounding use of data when it comes to groundwater wells. You can absolutely know which well you're talking about and which well construction record, which the health department has been logging since the mid-70s, you're dealing with. So that system has set an incredibly useful foundation, again, the envy of all other states who do not have that record, even though it's 40 years. The federal government and other states are just starting to talk about making sure that every state has a well identification system that codifies well codes correctly.
Other questions? Brian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on these appropriation permits. First of all, it seems that it would be useful, even for those areas of the state that are not suffering from low water conditions, to know where these wells are to be utilized in either their local comprehensive water plan, their watershed district plan, watershed plans, what have you. So question number one, is there a database that's available? And number two, what is the DNR's authority on these wells? It sounds like in your presentation that once a well is permitted, it's in perpetuity. You referenced it's the million-gallon level. Well, if they get a million-gallon permit, is it 10 million, 20 million, 30 million? And then what authority does the DNR have in terms of where in a dry spell you're going to have to cut down? Or once it's permitted, is it a permit?
All very good questions, Mr. Chair and committee. Now I'm trying to remember the first part of the very first question. I was ready to give it. I was going to write it down.
The database.
And specifically, what was it about the database?
Is there a database of these permitted
yes.
wells statewide?
Thank you. Yes, and it's available on our website. We have it's an interactive tool. It's a map. You can see these wherever we have well data. You can click on the dot and then get access to that data through our website. We're trying to make that better, but it's
well data.
Yes,
Jason, not private well data.
Not private well data. not the individual use. Well, you can get that data is also available, the water use data, but the monitoring wells that we have, all that data is available through our website.
Okay, and I was speaking specifically to the private wells. So if somebody, if you're doing a water plan in a county that's got 25 million gallon wells, it'd be good information to have.
Yeah, so the Department of Health maintains a database of all the wells in the state of Minnesota. And then the appropriations that go with those wells are available through our website and are published on an annual basis in the water use reports, and then there's continuous. So that information is available. But one of the things that you're getting at, and I think comes up in some of the later presentations as well, is that we haven't historically always made information, data and information available in the most user-friendly way. And that's part of the interagency efforts right now is to figure out who's using what and how can we get this, how do we serve it up for them better? You know, it's that hasn't been a focus and it hasn't been very well funded, but we're making tremendous progress on that. And we've got several work groups working on that to make it better. The second part of your question was about the appropriation permits. We can amend, modify, or terminate a permit at any time. But the notion is that you only do that if there's a problem. So if there's a sustainability issue, if we determine that, let's say, a few permits are causing an interference with somebody's private domestic well, and that the only way to resolve that, maybe you can't lower the pump in that well, you can't replace that well because it's in the deepest part of the aquifer or something like that. And if the only way to resolve that would be to modify the permits around it, then we have the authority to do that. And so you can say, well, here, the way this will work is that if you only use water on this day and you're on, you know, and you could work through how it gets used to resolve an interference. That's just an example, but we do have that authority.
Okay. Tom, and then Chris.
Mr. Chair, another question Commissioner Knapsett asked was about what we permit, and the million gallons is a million gallons per year or 10,000 right. gallons per day. But if a proposal asks for that much water, then we permit it.
Christine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very interested in the work that you've been doing on tracking and mapping where the recharge areas are. And from the perspective in the Hiawatha Valley, I know we've really appreciated the information we've gotten from DNR on how to regard bluffs that way. I wonder, for the purpose of land use planning, that would seem to be quite a critical matter. And I'm wondering what plans you have for making that information more available to local units for planning.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for that question. For the Mount Simon study that I mentioned in the presentation, we hosted a workshop and we invited in all the local units of government to come and learn about what we found in the study. We provided them some maps. We've produced a video that they can play at their city councils to raise awareness about what's going on and the understanding that we now have. But really, in the end, it's our Atlas program produces these maps. We go out to the counties. We meet with the municipalities. As we produce these maps, we sit down and say, here's what we've learned. And here's how you can use this information to inform your planning decisions. I recently was out in Carver County. We just published the Carver County Atlas. So that's the way that we do that. You know, the recharge areas and the sensitivities and all that is identified in those Atlas maps. Now, unfortunately, we don't have Atlas maps all around the state yet. We're accelerating getting those done more quickly. The legislature and the LCCMR and Clean Water Fund are helping us to do that, and we're trying now, the timeline is to get it done in about 15 years for the whole state.
But the recharge areas are on the existing map.
That's right, yes. Those are on the county geologic atlas maps that we produce.
I'd like to continue the discussion more, but I'm afraid we're running out of time. Again, thank you very much, Jason, for your excellent presentation and very thorough presentation.
So thank you.
Thank you. I want to ask Melissa Lewis to please come on up, and Melissa is from the Board of Water and Soil Resources and is going to present on One Watershed, One Plan, and then following Melissa's presentation, I'll ask Assistant Commissioner Woolman and Brad Redland to come up and talk about ag water quality certification. We should be done here by 4 o'clock. Welcome, Melissa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Again, I'm Melissa Lewis. I'm the Water Plan and Policy Coordinator at the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and here to tell you a little bit about the One Watershed, One Plan initiative, which is quickly turning into a program. And the vision of this program, I'm going to stick with program, is to align local water planning on major watersheds, major watershed boundaries with state strategies towards prioritized, targeted, and measurable implementation plans. So what does that mean? Well, first I'll tell you a little bit about the history and the drivers behind One Watershed, One Plan. Then I'll tell you a little bit more about the program itself, and then how we're going to get the program going through some pilot watershed areas. So you already did get a much more thorough timeline, so I'll give you an abbreviated version that water planning and local water planning in the state has got a very long history, back to the 30s with soil conservation law, the 50s with the Watershed Act, the 80s with the Metropolitan Surface Water Management Act, and the Comprehensive Local Water Planning. So we're really not starting from scratch with One Watershed, One Plan. And the more recent is the 2012 One Watershed, One Plan legislation, which allowed Bowser to develop policies, resolutions, and orders to let watershed plans substitute or replace each other. And when I'm talking about watershed plans, I'm talking about soil and water conservation district comprehensive plans, county local water plans, and watershed district comprehensive plans. The legislation also required Bowser to develop a suggested boundary framework, which is kind of unique language, I think, in that it's a suggested boundary. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a bit. But stepping back a little bit is, where did that legislation come from? Well, I think you've heard some already today about some of that, the legislative signals in around 2010 of there's just too many players, and that was towards the local governments and those local plans as well as the state agencies. And so the response of some of those local governments, the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts, the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts, and the League of Minnesota Cities got together based on that legislative signal and had a water summit with over 380 local government representatives meeting in St. Cloud and talking about these issues. From that summit, this local government water roundtable established three advisory committees of local governments that talked about some of the major issues that they were hearing about, and in 2013 developed a policy paper that came up with a series of recommendations. And those recommendations included using major watersheds for water planning, streamlining existing statutes, being predictable, and removing some of the barriers for local governments to work together on water planning. And as you also heard there, the 2013 governance evaluation was also very influential in One Watershed, One Plan. The other drivers you've heard about already today, too, are the 2006 Clean Water Legacy Act, which really provided policy and direction for impaired waters, the 2008 amendment that provided funding, and in 2013, the Minnesota Clean Water Accountability Act, which really established that 10-year watershed approach, the RAPS, Watershed Restoration and Protection Strategies, and some of the requirements for tracking and measuring our accomplishments. And again, you've already seen this diagram once today, and the area that I'm really going to be focusing on is that red arrow, the arrow that is really the connecting all of those state programs with local leadership into comprehensive watershed management plans. So One Watershed, One Plan. Where we are right now in our transformation from an initiative to a program is in December of 2013, the Bowser Board adopted a set of guiding principles. These guiding principles were extensively reviewed by the Bowser Board. We had a committee with representatives from the agencies as well as the local governments involved, and they talked long and hard about what should go into these guiding principles. And some of the highlights of those principles are that we should be leveraging that long history that we have in Minnesota. We should be streamlining our plans, using those streamlined plans to gain efficiencies in implementation, working across county boundaries and watershed district boundaries, and working between SWCDs and counties and watershed districts to implement water in a more efficient way. We need to build off the watershed approach. The state is investing a significant amount of time and energy into the watershed approach. We need to use the data and information and assessments and strategies from the watershed approach in local water plans. Through that watershed approach, we have data and information like we've never had before. We should need to be systematic and science-based about our water plans. These plans also need to be driven by local governments. Those are the places where a lot of this implementation occurs. I mean, listening to Jason talk about, you know, the city of Woodbury and the changes that they're making, you know, we can come up with ideas of the state, but the changes that are going to occur that are going to change water management are really at the local level. So those plans need to be driven by local governments. But the plans also need to be better prioritized and targeted. We need to make sure that, you know, those amendment dollars that we're using and general fund dollars that we're using are going to the things that are going to have the biggest bang for the buck, that they need to be capable of achieving measurable results, and that we may need to be able to actually track how those measurable results are changing things. So back to that suggested boundary map. Our Bowser Board Committee also had a long conversation about how to develop a suggested boundary map. We have a history in the Metropolitan Surface Water Management Act of, you know, mandating boundaries that didn't work all that well. When I know in the 80s when those boundaries were mandated, it seemed probably like a really good idea, and I think we maybe have half as many now as we did in the early 80s when those were established. And so we kind of learned from that experience and said, well, let's be a little bit more flexible on this. So we started with the 81 major hydrologic units of the state as a starting point. We had a comment period earlier this year on, if you were to be planning on a watershed basis, what would make most sense? There's some areas of the state, such as down in the Minnesota River, where the major watershed is on both sides of the river, and there's already an established organization on each side, and so keeping that as one boundary didn't make sense, so splitting it in two made more sense locally, so that was a suggestion. The edges of the state where we've got multiple major watersheds, you know, based on the watershed numbers, but they're grouped next to each other and they're all flowing maybe to Iowa. I mean, for planning for our counties, it'd be more efficient if they could just plan for those all at once. So down in the Root River in the southeastern corner of the state, you can see there's a boundary for the Root River, and it combines and includes some of the smaller watersheds flowing in different directions. This map was adopted by the Bowser Board in April, and again, it remains suggested and includes some guidance and criteria for if, as these local governments get into this planning effort, they find that, well, we thought that was going to make sense, but it really doesn't now. We have a process and procedures for changing the boundary and changing the map. The other thing that we've done recently is we developed operating procedures for pilot watersheds. The legislation that we got in 2012 was really very short. It was two paragraphs that told us how to change water management on the local scale from county-based planning and watershed districts to watershed-based planning, and that was two paragraphs when, I mean, most of our statutes and rules are give us quite a bit more direction than that. So we thought, well, with those policies and procedures we're going to develop, what we want to do first is pilot them and see how it works, see if the ideas and that learning that we have from our long history will be the best way to move forward. So the Bowser Board adopted operating procedures in June that really outlined some steps on how we'd move from county-based local water plans, SWC comp plans, how we merge those things together with watershed district plans on a watershed basis across the state. So we'll pilot those. We're working on plan content requirements. So as we talk about wanting to have science-based plans that are better prioritized, more easily measurable, what does that mean? If you set the bar too high on that plan content, can we achieve that? So we're working through the summer on developing some plan content requirements that will also be included in the piloting of this program. And some of the highlights of the plan contents is that it's going to have some requirements for setting priorities, for establishing some measurable goals, and really the emphasis that we're looking at is having a very targeted and measurable implementation schedule. We really want to see these plans to be plans to do, and so that implementation schedule and implementation plan should be very clear about who's going to do what, where it's going to happen, how we're going to measure it, and what's our expected result. Another big piece of what we're working on this summer is really investigating when we talk about prioritized, targeted, and measurable, those words, PTM, it's becoming a noun and a verb all on its own, and we're trying to make an acronym out of it, and it really doesn't make sense. So So we're investigating what those concepts really mean in terms of water planning. So we're looking at what approaches we might use to achieve that in planning, and looking at different models and tools that could be used. And we've been partnering with the University of Minnesota on investigating what some of those options might be. So what we're looking at right now is the concept for prioritize. If you look at the straight definition of prioritize, it's ranking things in order of importance. If you start talking about prioritize in terms of water planning, it's integrated and threaded all the way through a water plan. There's not a way to tease out this is what prioritize means in a plan. So prioritize in terms of planning, we're kind of saying the concept is prioritizing the water or natural resources and associated issues and prioritizing the strategies and actions to address those issues. There's also the prioritization of water and natural resources, often sometimes referred to as geographic targeting. So we get to mixing those two terms right away from the get-go. So we're trying not to stick with this is absolute, but say this is the concept here. One way that we already have an example of how prioritization could work is an example from the Crow Wing County Water Plan. And this took available information that they had and put it together in layers in a GIS exercise. So we're looking at tools and different ways to prioritize. And this was an example of a GIS analysis that took different levels of priorities or different levels of issues and layered them together. And then the end, Crow Wing County looked at a risk classification as their method of prioritizing that based on land use in this case of how much of the land is protected, how much of it is disturbed, what are the water quality trends. There's a small pink area kind of in the right-hand center of Crow Wing County, and that's Serpent Lake, and that has a downward water quality trend that they don't see in other lakes in that area. So that became the priority because they can see that there's something that needs to happen. So the concept for targeting, again, if you go just to the dictionary, it's something aimed at or something to do, something to achieve. And what we're saying when we're talking about targeting is it's taking a closer look at those priority issues and identifying specific actions, locations, and management practices for addressing those issues. Targeting is hard to tease out from prioritizing, and so this is an example of a map from the Sauk River Watershed District Watershed Management Plan. This is they broke their watershed district, which is a major watershed. It's the size of a major watershed already, and they broke it into 10 management units. And so this is their Osakis Lake Management Unit, so about a tenth of a major watershed. And within that watershed, they identified that Osakis Lake, which is an impaired lake, is their priority in that management unit. So if you see the watershed to Osakis Lake is where all the colors are. They've targeted the majority of their actions into those areas. They've also prioritized those actions by saying that, you know, the orange is priority for nutrient management, but the red is the high priority for nutrient management. So they're targeting and prioritizing all in one spot. So the concept of measuring, again, go to the dictionary, and it's a standard for figuring a size or an amount or a degree of something. What we're calling it is a ability to demonstrate progress toward the achievement of goals over time. And we're kind of breaking that again then into two, that there's an approach of measuring activity. So if you're using a model to say, if I do these number of practices, I'm going to get this kind of change, then measuring over the time, the lifespan of a 10-year water plan might be measuring the amount of activity you do. But there's also measuring results, which can be very important as well. So depending on what the priorities, actions, and goals are, you might want to invest some in monitoring specifically and measuring through monitoring. But we can't afford to monitor absolutely everything. So an example would be of kind of how these concepts are tied all together is the Pope SWCD in Lake Minnewaska. And this is an example both of you know, what we have existing that we can build off of, but then also recognizing that this wealth of consistent data and information that we've got that we've been talking about today can really help improve and stretch this to many areas of the state. So Pope SWCD prioritized Lake Minnewaska both because it was a TMDL lake, an impaired lake, and there was completed TMDL, so they know what they need to do. And it's also a high-value lake locally. I mean, you can see it's probably highly used. I don't know the lake myself. But they took a look at that lake, and then they looked even closer, and they used LIDAR data to pinpoint where they could put water and sediment control basins, where they might have ravine issues and shoreline issues. And the SWCD is partnering with the Chippewa Watershed Project, and the Chippewa Watershed Project is monitoring this lake specifically because of its high value. Another example is the Chisago SWCD and the Chisago County. The county water plan identifies St. Croix, the St. Croix River, as a high priority. The SWCD adopts the county water plan right now as their comprehensive plan. Lake St. Croix, so the stretch of the St. Croix River from the Stillwater River Bridge down to Hastings, is designated as impaired for phosphorus. It has a completed TMDL. One of the contributors of that phosphorus is that direct drainages all along the St. Croix in Chisago County. There's a lot of gullies. It's a steep bluffland area. So the SWCD mapped and inventoried those gullies and started meeting with landowners and saying, hey, we really have an issue out there, and then started applying for clean water funds to repair those gullies. In this case, monitoring the St. Croix to see how the repair of one gully is probably not the most effective way to measure, but they can measure by using the estimated reductions based on the scale and size of projects that they're installing and inputting that into the models. Another example is the Wilkin County SSTS program. They prioritize the SSTS sites that aren't meeting their county and state regulations. They inventoried to see which ones needed fixing, and they've been implementing those fixes over time, and the Lower Otter Tail River has already been delisted. So we have lots of examples out there of good ways that we can be implementing. But the thing with those examples I just gave you is most of those are based on county water plans, which is a jurisdictional boundary, and what we're trying to do is evolve into managing water on a watershed basis. So what we've done is we opened up a request for information, and we asked our local governments to propose how they might help us learn how to pilot this program. We had 13 applications, and we selected 5 in June. Mm-hmm. Our request of those pilot watersheds is that they're going to be writing plans, that those plans will be completed by late 2015. They're going to be piloting both the concepts I've just presented, the operating procedures, the plan content that we're developing, and the whole process as a whole. And I'd say as well that this is a piloting for the agencies. We've talked today about, you know, how the agencies fit into this water quality approach and water quality framework, and we're all figuring our way through that as well. So I've been meeting and talking with the agency staff in our selected pilot watersheds and saying, you know, this is a pilot for you too. We want to learn from you as well, so let's keep the conversation open. So the locations of our pilot, Red Lake River, Lake Superior North, the North Fork of the Crow, which includes some of the Bonanza River Valley that you were hearing about earlier, the Yellow Medicine River, and the Root River. And I got to say that if you run into any of the local governments that are any part of these pilots, give them a big thanks. I think it's very, very brave and exciting that they're willing to basically jump in blindfolded. We asked them to say, how would you do this before we even had operating procedures or planned content? They're willing to help us figure out how this goes without even knowing all the details of what we're doing. And they're all really excited to do it. So I got to extend my appreciation. So what's next? As I said, we're working on planned content. We're going to try and get that wrapped up by September, which is coinciding with about the time that those pilot areas will be kicking off their planning efforts. We're going to be learning from those pilots through 2014 and 2015. Should also mention that we're partnering with University of Minnesota Extension on establishing some evaluation protocols for us so that we are really doing a thorough job of learning from the beginning and the end of the process. We're going to be pulling everything that we learned together and drafting some policies in the summer and fall of 2015, and we anticipate in the fall of 2015 having those open for broad comment, and anticipating that we'd adopt a final program in December.
Well, thank you.
Yes.
Questions for Melissa or Brian? Tom?
Yes, just one question, Mr. Chairman. Melissa, the final adoption of the program in 2015, does that mean then we're planning on kind of offering it to all watershed statewide?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, the idea would be that at this point we're piloting, and so those that are interested in participating before we launch the full program, we'd ask that they wait until we get the program in place. And at that point, it would be launched and available to any organization that would want to follow the planning boundaries.
Good. Chair?
John?
Thanks. Great presentation. I'm really excited about the, you know, that 13 applied. I think that's good news that so many local government entities wanted to make a run for it, you know, the blind jump. I think that's a really good metaphor. I would really, and from an EQB perspective, Mr. Chair, this is a comment, not a question. I would like to see EQB evaluate how well the state agencies perform in delivering assistance to the local units of government that make the transition to one plan for one watershed, because that's really where breakdown can occur. Equally, you know, there can be problems at the local government level as well, but we have state agencies as our charge and our purview. We should really assess our own staff's performance in supporting those local governments that took that initiative.
Do you have an idea of what the yardstick by which we will measure our success will look like?
I don't, Mr. Chair, but I really would like to suggest that we work, you know, with the board staff, as because I think their local units of government will have a good opinion about how we should be rated. I think that would be a good starting place. Our teams, we clearly want this to happen at the PCA. This is music to my ears. A watershed scale implementation planning that's prioritized and targeted is exactly what we have wanted to achieve as well. So I'd be open to getting the ideas from the local governments about what successful support from the state agencies really means.
Other questions or comments? Please, Sandy.
Yes, I thought this was an excellent presentation. What are you hearing back from your counties if they are situated in several watershed districts, or vice versa? You have a watershed district that has several counties. How are you managing this interlocal government complexity?
Mr. Chair, members. We're having conversations about that, and that's part of why we want to have flexibility in the boundaries. We do want the boundaries to be maintained as much as possible on a watershed basis. And I think that's part of what we want to learn from the pilots, but I do think that we have some history in that in the metropolitan area, but at a different scale of watershed districts working and water management organizations in the metro area working with cities, and many of those cities are in multiple areas. So I think we have some ways to work through it, and I think the transition will be a challenge for everyone.
Mr. Chair.
Please, Brian.
I think you've identified precisely the largest challenge. I'm confident that our partners in the agencies are going to step up to the plate. The relationships are well established at local level. Now, measuring that is a good thing, but I'm confident that our partners will be there. The area that's going to be difficult is the majority of the state of Minnesota water planning is done at a county-based level, a political boundary. And you saw the complexity of the map, the watersheds. So in my county, we have portions of 6 watersheds. That means we will be working, well, once this is rolled out, we're not one of the pilots, but we would be compelled to work with many counties around us. And I guess I would just suggest it would be akin to suggesting that the state of Minnesota has to partner with South Dakota to get South Dakota and Minnesota, or North Dakota, to get a job done. You really don't have any authority to tell them to do anything, but you've been drawn into this partnership, and you hope everybody's committed to making it work. It will be interesting to see how it works, particularly given the fact that the funding streams have always been destined at a political level. And now we're looking at figuring out how that comprehensive water funding, well, in this case, the pilot is funding the project, but in the future, how do these local water planning dollars get allocated across a watershed? I may have 66% of a watershed in my county in one watershed, but only 3% of another watershed that's also in the county. And how are those funds allocated? That's what we're hoping the pilot teaches us.
Excellent. Well, maybe we can get a sense of what collaboration actually looks like with the next presentation with Brad and Matt. Thank you so much, Melissa. Thanks for the excellent presentation. Assistant Commissioner Matt Wollman and Brad Redland here to talk about the Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the board, for the opportunity to join you to talk about the Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program. My presentation will be broken into two parts, one talking about the program development of the this new approach, and then the second part talking about the program implementation that we've undertaken. This whole program started about 2 years ago as Governor Dayton and Secretary Vilsack and EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson got together at the state capitol and signed a memorandum of understanding to support a voluntary program to enhance water quality in Minnesota and accelerate adoption of best management practices on Minnesota farms. And it works, it directs all of our state agencies that deal with water issues, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Bowser, Department of Ag, Minnesota DNR, to coordinate with our federal partners to coordinate and prioritize funding for this program. It also suggests that the stakeholders want to provide recognition and certainty not only to Minnesota farmers but also to the public. And then the MOU directed the establishment of an advisory committee, which I'll talk a little bit about. The advisory committee was made up of 15 members consisting of farmers, environmental folks, conservation folks, local government, and they were really charged with putting together the initial recommendations of how this program would be developed. You know, at the early onset with the memorandum of understanding, the governor and the secretary, along with some of the commissioners, that had provided a very high-level vision of what this program would be. But really wanted to work with the stakeholders to develop the program from the ground up rather than having a plan that was presented for comment. So this advisory committee worked through the better part of a year. They're still in place and are working on the implementation part now. But they provided recommendations to the commissioner on pilot projects, you know, how would we deal with the implementation, how the program would operate, what the measurement tools should look like, how we would manage data, which surprisingly is a very controversial issue, and what certainty means, incentives to get folks in the door and to participate, and then how we would promote the program. The recommendations were then given to Commissioner Fredrickson, and that became the basis for legislation that was passed this, not last session, but the previous session. And it provided $3 million in clean water legacy funding. And the statute basically provided or directed the agency to pilot the program for up to 3 years. It provided a mechanism for how the program could be rolled out statewide. There's a review process for the committee and an interagency team, and it provides the definition and the scope of what certainty is and what the roles and responsibilities are of both the producer and the state. The governor also issued an executive order which builds on the interagency partnership, and I have to say that the interagency partners that have been a part of this effort have been a fantastic group to work with. They provided some great insight and recommendations on how to implement this program. And so the executive order really built on that that interagency partnership. And to streamline and make the program effective in terms of who would sign the certification contracts and so forth, that was laid out in the executive order, as well as laying out the requirement that all agencies would honor the contracts when implementing new water quality laws or rules. So the certification contract is really a contract between the producer and the state of Minnesota. And it outlines the roles and responsibilities of the producer and the responsibilities of the state. It defines what certainty means, and it grants it to the producer, and it also defines what requirements and conservation practices would need to remain in place for the duration of the contract. So what is certainty? It's a question that's been asked quite a bit. It's offered by Minnesota state government via certification contracts. It's not an exemption from any existing rules or laws. It's relevant to land within an agricultural production or operation, and it's conditional upon implementing the recommended practices and maintaining those practices. If you look on the bottom, certainty means that they're deemed to be in compliance with any new water quality laws or rules and considered to be meeting their contributions to any targeted reductions of pollutants. What this really is an insurance policy against a moving regulatory goalpost. That's what certainty is. So in terms of the program implementation, I'll walk through a little bit of the work that we've done on our pilot projects, the certification process, as well as the program incentives. This is a map that shows where we are piloting the program. We're piloting in four watersheds across the state. We're trying to give some good geographic diversity, different types of agricultural operations, different hydrology, geology, et cetera. You have the Whitewater watershed in southeastern Minnesota, the Elm Creek watershed in southwest. In central Minnesota, we have the Middle Sauk, and then the Whiskey Creek watershed, which is part of the Buffalo Red in northwestern Minnesota. So the pilots are, as I said, a diverse group in terms of geology, agriculture, water quality concerns, governance structures. Some of them are SWCDs, some of them are watershed districts. And so we're learning through this process, and that's really what the pilot projects are all about. In each of the pilot areas, we've established local advisory committees made up of farmers and folks that are interested in those local areas to help direct the work locally and to get some feedback from them on how things are working on the ground level. Yeah. We are doing outreach to producers in the pilot areas by hosting open houses with the pilot watershed folks, as well as mailings, radio, print media, doing surveys and advocacy from the local advisory committee. So the certification process, the very first step is really to do a self-assessment. If you're a producer, you do a self-assessment. We have a worksheet that helps them do that. Then they would come in working with the local SWCD. They would do a certification assessment. But before that, if they identify that they have some problems or they need to make some enhancements, they can go into this realm of technical and financial assistance. And that's where they would get the help that they need to implement a certain practice, get the engineering done so it's done properly, et cetera. Then you would move over to the field verification. That's when a certifier would come out and certify that farm as meeting the water quality goals of the program and I'll show you a little bit later, we have an assessment tool that helps us walk through and determine whether they're certifiable. And then it's a 4-page contract, really simple. We don't want to have a whole bunch of paper out there, so 4 pages, and there's optional informed consent. So if they want to use this as a marketing tool, or if they want to get some extra recognition, they can basically consent to be publicly acknowledged for that. And then they are certified as meeting the water quality goals of the program. So the certification process, as I said earlier, you cannot, it's not an exemption from any existing rules or laws. You need to be in compliance with all of the rules and laws that are on the books at the time of certification. And so this is just a checklist to help them walk through some of the higher level issues that we see. So for example, are you in compliance if you have a feedlot? Are you in compliance with your MPDES or state permit? Do you have properly, are you properly disposing of your pesticide containers, septic systems? Do you have the appropriate water body setbacks if you have a stream coming through your farm, et cetera? And so the producer self-certifies that they're in compliance with these things, and you know they can get their answers or assurance by going to their county office or what have you to get the answers to these questions. The assessment tool looks at 6 different areas. What are the physical field characteristics that we're working with? You know, are we working with a piece of flat square land in Renville County, or are we dealing with some rolling hills, steep rolling hills in some cases in southeastern Minnesota? Different soil types, erosion factors, et cetera. What kind of nutrient management are we using on these farms? What kind of tillage do we have? How are we managing pests? This is our pesticide management. Do we have irrigation or drainage water management that we're undertaking on these lands? And then looking at conservation, not only conservation practices that have already been installed, but what additional conservation practices do we need to install? So we developed a tool that's specifically designed for Minnesota. It's based off of the Water Quality Index from NRCS. It's parcel specific, and every crop that you grow in a rotation gets an assessment through this tool. It's a systems approach rather than a one specific approach. So we're looking at all of these various different factors rather than focusing just on a conservation practice or just on a nutrient management. We're looking at all of them together and how they interact with each other. So in terms of nutrient management, obviously if you apply no nitrogen or if you have a legume crop like an alfalfa, you're going to score pretty well. If you are meeting the BMP recommendations that are laid out by the University of Minnesota in terms of your rate for nitrogen, you're going to get a 10. If you're over-applying, that's when the score begins to drop. The same is true as we're looking at nutrient management, timing, source, and placement. So what's the timing of the nitrogen application? Are we applying that in the spring as close to the planting season as possible? Are we applying it in the fall? Are we applying it when temperatures are greater or less than 50 degrees? That has a lot of impact on whether the nitrogen is going to volatilize into the atmosphere, or leach into groundwater? Or are we applying it on frozen soil, for example, that will contribute to runoff? So we score these things based on what you're actually doing on your specific farm. In terms of tillage management, no-till obviously scores very well. Intensive tillage is going to score less well. And we base that off of each individual type of tillage practice. Each pass across the field has some sort of stir in the soil, and so we have that. There's an adding factor that allows us to determine what the stir value is. In terms of our pest management, looking at basic pest control down on the bottom, are you just following the label on the pesticide law, in terms of the law, or are you going above and beyond? Are you going out there and scouting and determining what your pest thresholds are before you're spraying? Are you mixing up your modes of action? Are you adding in, certain types of natural types of pesticide products that would help you to use less of a product in the future? So those advanced IPMs are more advanced in terms of using the different actions that are available. And we have a manual that allows us to look at each of, pest control, basic pest control, all the way up to advanced pest control, and it'll tell you exactly what is in and out. So if you look, for example, basic pest control is, reads the labels and abides by the labels. Then advanced, you're adjusting, planting rates, timing, crop rotation, irrigation schedules, the type of machinery, you're cleaning it, doing the scouting, et cetera. So that's an important part of managing pesticides well. In terms of irrigation management, if you have a center pivot irrigation, you're going to have more opportunity to leach into groundwater, and so that's a negative 10% adjustment on your score. So that would be probably the main item there that you'd be interested in. And in terms of drain tile, we have two really big types of drain tile in Minnesota. Open surface inlets. This is literally a pipe that's open on the surface of the soil. And then you have drain tile with no surface inlets. And you can see how it different, the different levels of adjustment to the scores. One thing I would note is if you have drain tile with no open surface inlets and your average nutrient management and tillage management score is greater than 9, there would be no adjustment. And so what we're saying is that between 0 and 10, a producer has to get an 8.5 in order to be certified. And so if you're doing really well on your nutrient management and really well on your tillage management, and you still have drain tile, there would be no adjustment. In terms of conservation practices, the Department of Agriculture put together this Ag BMP handbook for Minnesota, and it pulls together all of the literature on various different conservation practices. And if you look here, you can see in terms of the various different practices, how effective are they at addressing sediment, for example? How effective are they at addressing phosphorus or nitrogen or pesticide residues, et cetera? And those, as you choose the practices that you are going to use on your particular farm, these effectiveness scores start to build into the scoring process. We, after we run the tool, we do an on-site field verification. You can see here a farmer, and this is in central Minnesota in the Middle Sauk River watershed. Our staff and the SWCD staff are out, and they're scouting one of our certified farmers. And, you know, they're looking for the appropriate setbacks. They're examining the tile inlets. They're looking at susceptible gullies, tillage and crop rotation, et cetera. So the program incentives, one of the big things that I've heard from producers going around the state is that the biggest thing for them is the recognition. They want to be recognized as being responsible stewards of water quality and raising a good product. To some extent, and to some producers, regulatory certainty is important to them. They want to know that they have some certainty in terms of what the environment is going to look like for them moving out over the next 10 years. And some of them are saying that financial and technical assistance is really important, that they wouldn't have the resources or the expertise to be able to implement these practices without those funds. But I would also note that there are a fair number of producers who are going through the process, and there's one that's certified today that made about $40,000 worth of conservation practice improvements and paid for it out of his own pocket. So not everybody is going after the technical and financial assistance. In terms of the program evaluation, we're in the process of doing an assessment on our tool to determine, it's called a sensitivity analysis. That's a research term, but we're looking at the tool to determine how effective it is at actually reducing nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment, et cetera. We're working with each of the various different pilot areas to get feedback from them on how we can improve the program and make it more effective. Also discussing and having ongoing conversations with the participants who have already been certified or are going through the certification process to get their feedback as well. And then we're doing a knowledge attitudes assessment of each of these different pilot areas to understand what level of knowledge and understanding is there on the ground today, and then looking 3 years from now, what kind of knowledge will we have at that point and be able to see the adjustments over time. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll pause, and if anybody has any questions, I'll let Matt, Brad ask answer the hard questions.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You might mention just briefly the amount of federal dollars that happen to be committed to the program.
Yes, we have $3 million appropriated from the Clean Water Legacy Fund for the program, which leveraged $6 million in federal EQIP dollars, plus $500,000 for technical assistance. So $6.5 million in federal funds were leveraged.
And then again, you might mention, and Brad, maybe you can, but the collaborative work that DNR, Bowser, and MPCA and MDA had to do to move this project forward was no small feat. Mm-hmm. And I just want to acknowledge that first of all, they gave me permission to sign off. Now, that's really a significant thing.
Questioned the wisdom.
That's right.
It was a weak moment.
That's right, yes. It probably wouldn't happen today, that's for sure. But
It has been great collaboration between the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Bowser, DNR, and it's been a great success story, I think, four agencies working together, understanding we all have different interests and jurisdictions and so forth, and coming together to make a program work for Minnesota. I think it's a real accomplishment.
And then, Brad, we've got about 3 minutes left, but in terms of just sheer numbers and what's happening on the ground right now.
Well, we have five fully certified and contracted producers in the state of Minnesota today. Considering that we were able to actually begin signing contracts just last month, we're pleased with the process that we're making so far. We have some scientific categories we're lining up other producers in, one of those categories being darn close. And we have 23 people resident in that darn close category right now today. And we have about 160 people have actually signed an application form, a self-certification checklist, and that commitment to enter into the program and participate in it to become assessed and certified. So we feel like this will be the summer of certification. We really want to keep the rolling going.
And I would just note, Mr. Chair, that you know we're working in relatively small areas of the state because you have four small watersheds. So to have that kind of participation already, I think, is a great testament of what we might be able to see out of this program.
Tom?
Mr. Chairman, and guys, just first off, this is very exciting, and thank you. I know this has taken an awful lot of work to get to this point. It was very exciting to see those first certification signed. And I'm wondering, you kind of alluded a little bit to the question I want to ask a moment ago, and that is, you know, when you think of participation, what are we going to consider success, you know, in terms of either number of proportion of farmers, proportion of acres in a particular watershed? Is there a goal we want to shoot for?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm hesitant to say a certain percentage of producers. I think what really is the indicator is, are we getting enough producers in enough of the right places doing enough of the right things so that we have an impact on water quality at the end of the day? Mm-hmm. And so for me, I think the indicator is, have we moved the needle on water quality in that watershed?
Mm-hmm. And we do have data that you know, you can't change what you don't measure, and so we're measuring, and at some point in time we ought to be able to have some comparative figures that will give us a sense of how we're doing.
Yeah, the Pollution Control Agency, through their 10-year watershed monitoring program, has been in each one of these watersheds, and so we have baseline water quality data for all four of the watersheds we're working in.
Mr. Chair, just an additional comment, because I think this fits so well with the previous presentation about RAPs, is when we start thinking about water quality at the watershed scale, you can identify if you're succeeding or not because you're looking at one outlet, if you will, at the bottom of the watershed. And when we start looking at how we nest these really small watersheds into the 81 major watersheds, into the bigger ones, we really start developing a system where we can have some goals and some accountability. And so it's very exciting to see this, and it'll be really exciting to see how this folds into the RAPS process and one watershed, one plan framework as we move along.
Julie?
I would ask Commissioner Fredrickson this, but he's stood me up about three or four times. But
Wait, I'll define that.
For our conference, we have a conference in Winnipeg, the Red River Basin Commission, and it's about Lake Winnipeg this year and water quality issues in the Red River Valley. And this sounds like, I mean, I know about this program, of course, but I think it'll be far enough along that if one of you two would like to come to Winnipeg and give a presentation. I'll email you.
We'll have to ask the commissioner about that.
Yeah. I don't know. But thank you.
I'd be happy to talk with you about it.
Mr. Chair.
Excellent.
Brian. Great presentation, Matt, and a good program as well. A question for you. The word certification means something to me, and it means something to me because in Aiken County we were certified, FSC certified. That happens to be Forest Sustainability Council certified. And I want to dwell on your word incentives. When we got certified, we were the first county in the state, I don't know, 15 years ago. Now you can't hardly sell timber in northern Minnesota if you're not FSC certified. In fact, if you look at the packaging on the boxes you buy, you'll see a little stamp FSC. That's Forest Sustainability Council. That means that wood has been harvested and handled responsibly from, you know, from the time it was planted or grown or whatever to the time it was harvested. So what I'm wondering is I know the program is in its infant stages now, but do you see a day, or are you already projecting a time where you're going to be talking to large food manufacturers, General Mills or whomever, and say, have you thought about buying certified crops? Should you be buying, you know, product off of certified farms? For us, it was, you know, first a push, and now, like I say, most producers, mills or pallet makers or whatever, won't buy the product unless it's coming off certified land.
Well, thank you for that question. Yes, the answer is yes. And we are already working with several companies. You know, General Mills has a vertical traceback. So, I mean, they know that, you know, a certain product that they're using in their supply chain all the way back to the particular farm that they're working with. And they're, you know, we have used the, you know, the concept of, you know, that seal on the front of the Wheaties box type of mentality. But we are working in the Middle Sauk River watershed. We're working with Golden Plump, and they have their Just Bear chicken brand is a sustainably, they're looking to make that a sustainably raised chicken product. And they are offering any certified producer in the Middle Sauk River watershed $5 an acre for getting certified. That's a private investment that they're making on behalf of the program. So, yes, it's in the very infant stages. We're already working with various different groups to get ag industry and agribusiness folks together to talk about what kind of incentive or participation that they would like to have in this program. But I think there's great opportunity in that arena as we move forward.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? If not, the hour is 4:05. Tom?
Mr. Chair, it was not to this, so I was just holding off for a second if I could. Just a comment, an observation. It's why my brow was furrowed earlier, but I wanted to wait until we had this opportunity to hear all these presentations before I said it. And that is, you know, there's a lot of things going on, mm-hmm. and each agency has got a little bit of what's going on, and I liken it to a clock. You know, there's a lot of gears spinning here, but unless these gears are meshing, you know, the dial doesn't turn. And so I think, you know, bringing this back to the EQB, I think right now the agencies are coordinating very, very well. But I know that doesn't happen all the time under different administrations. And I think it's important for us to think about how we institutionalize this coordination. And because the agencies that are primarily involved with water are here, this seems to be the venue in which to do that. And I note further when I look at the list of statutes, and I appreciate that because I hadn't seen that, you know, one of them is to coordinate comprehensive long-range water resources planning. It's exactly the type of thing that, you know, has been happening sort of agency by agency, but not necessarily collaboratively. And so I don't have an answer today about how I think EQB plays a role here, but I think that's the task that we should ponder is how do we use this body as the entity that sort of coordinates these things and make sure that the investments are going in the right places for the right outcomes and provides that guidance to the agency. So, Mr. Chair, I just want to throw that out there because I think I've been pushing this water thing as much as anybody, and I want to sort of get us thinking about how we can use the value of this coordinating body to really maximize the benefit for the residents.
Well said, and I agree, and I think this was a first step in today to lay that on the table, and so I think we can certainly move forward. And I want to thank all of you, by the way, for sticking it out here today. This is a lot of information that got downloaded in a three-hour block of time, so thank you for hanging in. Is there a motion? Oh, thank you, by the way, Matt and Brad, for sitting out until 3:30 to get this done. So thanks.
Move to adjourn.
I'm going to pay for that. There's a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. Thank you very much.
No.
Meeting adjourned.